15 minutes late, according to the program. Can I have some order, honorable members? I'd like to welcome all of you to this public hearings of the ARA Committee dealing with the General Intelligence Law Amendment Bill. I'd just like to welcome the presence of the Inspector General of Intelligence, Ambassador Advocate Khadebe, and her assistant, who are mainly here in an observer's capacity. Also, Mr. Bob Mchlanga from the Minister's Office, the Minister of State Security. And then, as usual, we also have Mr. Herman Smuts from the Chief State Law Advisor's Office, who has been assisting the ad hoc committee and will be assisting the ad hoc committee throughout this process. For those of you that have not seen the program, the first presenter would be the Open Democracy Advice Center. After that, it would be Mr. Fani Badenhorst. The third presenter would be the South African History Archives. Then Dr. Masarumur Lee. And we would end off before lunch with the Right to Know campaign. So that is the order that the presentations will take place in. And we would expect the presenters to be available when they are called upon. You have all been notified that you would be given a half an hour to interact with the committee, 15 minutes to draw the committee to any of your points that you want to highlight, and 15 minutes to allow the committee to interact with you in terms of questions of clarification. I think the presenter should note that they should take it that the members of the committee have all read your presentations. So there's no need for you to read through your presentation. The members have read it. I think you would just be wasting valuable time that you could use in order to highlight some of the key issues that you would like the committee to take into consideration when dealing with this bill as time goes on. I don't have any apologies, Secretary. I'm sure that, except that I have been informed that Mr. Mania would be a few minutes late. So without much ado, if it is possible then, for the next half an hour, to have the Open Democracy and Advice Center to present to us what it is that you would like the committee to take into consideration when dealing with this bill. And we would please insist on the presenters to stick to the time, and if they also to introduce yourselves as you present. So over to the Open Democracy Advice Center.
Good morning, Chairperson and members of the committee. Thank you very much for the invitation to give submissions to this committee. My name is Alison Tilley, and I'm with the Open Democracy Advice Center, and I'm joined by Gabriella Razzano, who is also with the center. Just to say a few words about our organization, we focus on the Access to Information Act and the Protected Disclosures Act, and issues around transparency generally. So our particular area of expertise is in transparency issues and not necessarily in intelligence issues. But we've nevertheless made a submission which I think tries to highlight some of the transparency issues in terms of this legislation. In drawing your attention to the highlights in terms of our submission, I think we have introduced our submission with references to the sections in the Constitution, which you will all be familiar with, that govern this particular area. Let me get to the amendments directly. The bill removes the current subsection 5.6 that obliges the CEO to forward the report of the Auditor General and the annual report of the Academy Academy agency to the Minister and the relevant committees of Parliament. And we note that Section 199 provides for parliamentary oversight of the agency, which would include training expenses incurred by the agency. Now, we acknowledge that it may be possible to read into Section 3A1 of Act 40 of 1994 that these audited records would automatically include the additional audited records of the training fund. But this is not a certainty, particularly given the wording of that section, which refers to a singular audit report, which creates the, which implies the report created for the agency as a whole. Now, a separate audit report is created for the training agency. We would regard that as having to be accounted for in consideration of parliamentary oversight. The parliamentary committees have the power to receive audit reports, and we are arguing that it would lead to a very strange situation if the general finances of the security agency were subject to parliamentary oversight, but the training fund is not, because of the submission of particularized reporting. We can't presume it will form a portion of the larger audit report, because it has a specific audit under Section 5, which means it's separately managed. In the alternative to reinstating a reworded Section 5 that takes into account new entities, it should be expressly included as part of the report submitted to the Minister in terms of the new Section 10.5A as created by Section 23F of the bill. We'd like to commend some of the provisions made for consultation by the Minister with the advisory panels, and would encourage the exercise of these powers. There are labour vulnerabilities of security agency employees because of their exclusion from the Labour Relations Act, and additional advice sought could only be to their assistance. Looking at the question of amendments to the National Strategic Intelligence Act, the definition of national security is the definition as contained in the Protection of State Information Bill. We note that the definition of national security refers to the exposure of economic, scientific, or technological secrets vital to the Republic. Now, this is an issue that we raised with the committee in the NCOP dealing with this issue and this particular definition. There is no reference in this particular section of the definition to the question of vital to the defense of the Republic or vital to the security of the Republic. It simply says vital to the Republic, which is very broad, and we would argue not sufficiently specific enough, which is the same submission that we made to the COP yesterday. We are particularly concerned about economic secrets being held because of the concerns that exist at the moment and are very prevalent around corruption, and we think it would be a very good signal to try and open up that definition and make it absolutely clear that there is no intention to deal with general economic, scientific, or technological secrets, but those vital to the defense of the Republic. Um, In regard to the roles and functions of NECOC, we'd like to raise concerns around the rewording of Section 2 of the Act. The section has been amended and obliges NECOC to report national security intelligence products to the Minister and not to Cabinet, with the Cabinet only being informed as to these recommendations and not able to review the primary data that led to these recommendations. National executive oversight is required in terms of Section 199 of the Constitution. We do acknowledge that the newly inserted Section 4 is an important oversight mechanism, however. We particularly want to bring your attention to the question of NECOC. It's particularly necessary that this centralizing and coordinating power is legitimately Section 199D of the Constitution prescribes that national security is subject to the authority of Parliament and, of course, the National Executive. By removing the President, who's the head of the National Executive, his role in appointing to the head of NECOC, it does, we think, leave the position vulnerable to interference. We would say it would be constitutionally preferable if the new Section 5.1 prescribed that the President appoints the head of NECOC in consultation with the Minister, but that the Minister's approval is needed for the final decision, thus not reducing the importance of the Minister's involvement. We'd like to move on to the amendments to the Intelligence Services Oversight Act. We want to draw your attention to Section 5, in particular, of that Act, to give effect to real parliamentary oversight and powers provided for in Section 199 of the Constitution. We feel that Section 5 should not allow for a veto power for the head of service. The head of service and the Inspector General should be consulted when a decision under the subsection is made. In terms of Section 6.3, the standard for inclusion is unnecessarily vague in a section which is seeking to give meaning to parliamentary oversight. You might want to consider rephrasing it such as the inclusion of which will be demonstrably more harmful to the national security than its exclusion will be to the national interest. We'd also like to draw your attention to the recommendations of the Matthews Commission in regard to the audit reports, which are only made available to the committee as opposed to Parliament. The Matthews Act recommends that let me go back to what they describe the situation as. They suggest the situation is that budgets and financial reports are reviewed by the JSCI, which reports to Parliament, that these documents are regarded as confidential and are not presented to Parliament. So according to the National Treasury, the services are not directly accountable to Parliament for their budgets and spending. This is, according to the Matthews Commission, inconsistent with the Constitution, which states that national budgets must promote transparency and accountability. We would like to endorse National Treasury's proposal that the intelligence services should have their own vote in respect of monies approved annually by Parliament and should present their annual budgets and financial reports to Parliament. We would obviously not expect to disclose these documents, to disclose information that would prejudice security or that would compromise intelligence operations. Any sensitive information that is in those documents could obviously be redacted. Amendments to the Protection of Information Act. This is obviously a tricky in terms of the practical issues, because the Protection of Information Act is now under review, and it's going to be difficult to make sure that the sections cohere. We acknowledge the concerns raised by the Minister in the memorandum attached to the bill, but we do want to ask this committee to particularly pay attention to and ventilate the issues around centralizing control of the intelligence services. There have been many allegations and statements made of late that the intelligence services are being used in terms of political issues of the day. This is obviously something that will be of concern to the committee, and if there's any way of ameliorating that in terms of this legislation, we would urge the committee to take those steps. In conclusion, I'd just like to thank the committee for giving us the opportunity to make this presentation, and we will be available for questions if the committee has any questions for us. Thank you, Chairperson.
Are there any questions that you want to put to the presenter, honourable members? While the honourable members are thinking, the definition that you draw our attention to of national security is a definition that was very widely dealt with in the ad hoc committee dealing with the Protection of State Information Bill. Many months was spent on looking at a suitable definition, and the political parties themselves had spent a lot of time, and there had been a lot of horse trading regarding this thing until eventually the definition that is now presently in the bill is a definition that was reached by consensus. It is one of the things in the Protection of State Information Bill where all the parties were concerned, were satisfied. There was a lot of legal opinions that had been put forward, and a lot of changes had been made. So I'm just wondering whether you're aware of that. Also, the other thing regarding the definition is that that definition applies to the classification. It's a basis for classification. You will remember that the major concern that came out of the public hearings that the ad hoc committee dealt with, dealing with the Protection of Information Bill at the time, was the wide application. That first of all, it applied to many organs of state, and we had presentations on the amount of organs of state that could apply to and needed to be narrowed down. That was the argument. The next argument was that the basis for classification on national interest or public interest was far too wide. And you will recall then that it was on that concern that was raised and that objection that the basis of classification was actually changed to one of national security, changed from one of national interest, which was claimed to be too wide. So the definition as it applies in the Protection of State Information Bill at the moment is merely the basis for classification. And I think something that you're perhaps overlooking is that the bill as it now stands, the State Information, Protection of State Information Bill, applies only to your security forces set out in Section 11 of the Constitution. So that would only be your police, your defense, and your intelligence. I'm just worried that when you speak of corruption, if you are not perhaps referring to other organs of state to which the Protection of State Information Bill does not apply, and also that does not concern the civil intelligence, because they themselves would be bound, if that information bill became law, they would be bound by it, and their classifications would only be based on national security issues, nothing else. So they would be bound up by a separate law. And obviously, these amendments are meant to be consistent with it. I'm just concerned as a question whether you are familiar or whether you took note of those particular issues.
Thank you, Chairperson. Yes, indeed, I am familiar with those issues, and I am aware of the amendments that have been made to the Protection of State Information Law, which amendments have been a significant improvement on the original version of the legislation as tabled, and obviously came about as a result of a great deal of debate and submissions within the committee dealing with that issue. However, I would point out that aspect of the definition of national security remained contested by the civil society organizations involved in the process, and we do not regard the definition as it stands as being the best possible definition, despite the fact that it was subject to, as you say, horse trading. We don't think horse trading is necessarily the way to produce the best possible piece of legislation. Definition is now obviously in front of the Ad Hoc Committee and the National Council of Provinces, and similar representations have been made to that committee in relation to that particular issue. We are concerned about corruption within the security agencies to which this definition applies, and we have examples of corruption within the national security agencies, and particularly the state security agencies, which we raised in the committee yesterday, and in particular in relation to the medical aid run by the state security agency, which has apparently been subject to fraud over a number of years, which has been brought to the attention of a number of structures within the agency, including the Director General. So I think we have good reason to be concerned about these issues. And we have, I think, every hope that we will be able to persuade the committee in the National Council of Provinces that our view on this issue should prevail, because we really do, and I think the issues were raised most strongly by Corruption Watch yesterday afternoon in the committee, that we must fight the scourge of corruption on every front, that we can only combat it if we all deal with it at every level, and not just as legislators, not just as the executive, but as citizens, that it is our duty to become involved in that fight. We feel that this amendment to this particular definition would aid in that fight, and as I say, we are encouraging the National Council of Provinces to make that amendment, and we also encourage this committee to consider that amendment in the light of the other submissions we've made.
Honourable members. There seems to be no, I think, the Honourable Ngabadeli, and then the Honourable Fichler, and then the Honourable Lamagakane.
Thank you, Chair. Thanks to the President. I really appreciate and note that your organization focuses more on transparency and not on intelligence. The question is, in a submission that I read that was given to us, you made mention of the tricameral consultation that you had. It consists of security studies, South African history archives, and the right to know, which we appreciate so much. It's good to consult. But the question I want to pose to you is, did you focus as to why the amalgamation is necessary as outlined in the bill when the tricameral consultation met? Did Majesty, do focus on that. If so, are you opposed to the proposed amendment informed by the proclamation by the President in September 2009? Thank you, Chair.
Ask the Honourable Member to elaborate on the her question about the proclamation in September 2009.
The proclamation provides for the amalgamation or the consolidation of the civil intelligence services. I think what the Honourable Member is asking you, are you in principle against this consolidation of the intelligence services? Also, what she's asking, did when you met as your boss Parat, did you consider that particular issue, that it was good, this consolidation thing, whether it was something that you were going to support?
Chairperson, I can't say that there was a consensus arising out of that meeting. What I can say is that there are concerns about consolidation of these agencies. The original intention of separating out these agencies was, as we understand it, to create, to break up the sort of centralization of the intelligence services. Now, we are not in a position to know how this decentralization has in fact worked out. But we certainly, that was the original intention, and the original intention was to reduce the power of the centralized agency. However, we are aware of there being serious concerns about the management of the intelligence agencies, and we do see an argument in favor of consolidation. However, we would argue that any such consolidation does have to be met and supported by measures that would result in better transparency around those around the consolidated agencies.
The Honourable Fischler, and then the Honourable Ramathakane.
Yeah, I think the mere fact that we have established a single Director General who has become the accounting officer to all the other activities of the other agency. We had realized that it was a bit clumsy and there were a lot of loopholes on monitoring and controlling the auditing of the various agencies. So one single one that is going to be answerable to reporting to Minister and the JSCI becomes more refined, and it means there will be better control and of the auditing, because auditing will not be coming from the various agencies, but it will be coming from one source, and therefore being effectively monitored. And at the same time, controlling the question of corruption and all that. And I think that is what the approach.
I think it's a comment from the Honourable Fischler. I think he's merely explaining that the purpose behind the whole amalgamation. Is that correct, Honourable Member? Is that correct? It was merely a comment.
Are there fears of corruption and looseness from him? And that the purpose is trying to cap that?
Yeah, merely a comment. The Honourable Ramathakane and then the Honourable Sonto.
Thank you very much, Honourable Chair, and let's take the presenter. On page 4 of the document,
on the intelligence, amendment of the intelligence service and oversight. You speak about the Constitution section 199, and you seem to be worried about the issue about the veto power that should be managed. Can you elaborate what example of this would be that you seem to be worried about? You say nearly the Inspector General as well as the Head of Service should be consulted. I just want to understand what troubles you in this particular section. If you could make an example of this, what you call the veto power.
I'd like to ask my colleague to deal with that question.
Yeah, the answer is just a straightforward one, that we feel that maximizing consultations and these kinds of decisions is never a bad thing. It wasn't a particular point beyond that, I think. Does that answer your question?
Simple answer, the Honourable Member. The Honourable Santo.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. I think, Chairperson, looking at the presentation, I think it's appreciated. But as my colleague has said, you emphasized on transparency more than intelligence. Sort of a contrast on that one. So I think the committee would want to understand, are you saying the arrangement of amalgamation as opposed to the arrangement of decentralization would not serve the country better, the country and its people better? That is the one. The second one would be, looking at your presentation, and I'm sure the people that you've consulted with also have that kind of a fear. The presentation is littered with fear of corruption. Are you saying the decentralized, what is your experience as an organization? The decentralized arrangement, was it fraught of corruption? Or are you saying, should these agencies be amalgamated, they will be a corrupt entity? Is that what you're saying?
Thank you. I think that's a very interesting and quite a challenging question. It's certainly been our direct experience in terms of people who've come to us to blow the whistle on corruption, that there are issues around the way the agencies are currently structured, that issues around corruption are not being correctly dealt with at the moment. And I've mentioned the case that we've in particular been dealing with of late. The question as to whether amalgamation would better deal with corruption or deal with corruption less well, we think is largely dependent on the structures that are set up and the level of transparency that is allowed for. Now, transparency in national security issues is always an issue which is contentious, because there is always the concern, and I think there is a false dichotomy set up, that on the one side you have transparency and the other side you have national security, and that it's a battle between the two, and you have to balance those forces. I think the way our constitutional framework sets the issues out is that in terms of the way we've chosen to go forward as a constitutional step, is that we want to abide by the rule of law, and that we want to encourage maximum transparency and accountability that is consistent with a democratic society. But at the same time, there are reasonable limits that can be put in place in terms of transparency. And I think what we have looked at, particularly in terms of the Matthews report, is that there are a number of recommendations around transparency that are made in that report, which would go some way towards dealing with the corruption that we are aware of within the agencies. We do have to say, however, that I would like to say in relation to this, that it does seem that the Office of the Inspector General, in terms of providing an oversight function, has clearly not been something that has worked in this particular instance that we've looked at, and that there are that there has not been a response within the State Security Agency to reports of fraud. And we are extremely concerned about that. Now, whether the consolidation of these agents, as I say, the consolidations of the agency could go either way. It could either mean that there is better control, and I'm persuaded by Honourable Member Fischler's arguments around one accounting officer. I think that that's certainly persuasive. But I think that there is the concern that what this will mean is a consolidation of agencies, and that therefore that there is a higher risk for corruption, because then you don't contain, let's say that you have one part of the agency that is subject to corruption, but then it can be contained within that section, and that there are other sections that are functioning properly. But in this instance, you might risk a contagion within the agencies. And I think it's just something that we really want to draw to your attention and to ask you to be mindful of in your deliberations.
Honourable members, we're running out of time. Honourable Ramaphosa, you were not happy with the answer. They say lots of consultation is good. They don't really have another answer. So what more do you want? What more do you want them to say? I don't think they, from what I've heard, I don't think they have another answer. But I'd allow you to explore that thing very quickly if you so wish.
Yeah, okay. No. Well, I heard that, but I wasn't sure whether it was answering the question I was posing. Now, I was asking, in the section they speak about to give effect to parliamentary oversight, that section. And then it went further to say the Constitution, Section 199.5.2, that the veto power should not be allowed. So I was asking, in terms of this section, what is troubling you in terms of the possible vetoing of power? You're saying that the Inspector General, as well as the Head of Service, must need to be consulted. That's the latter part. I was asking the question earlier. What's worrying you around the veto of power on particular issue that you may have an example? But if you don't have an example, I'll accept that. It's made a statement. But I was asking that because it's linked to the constitutional provision as well as the issue of the oversight aspect.
You're standing by your answer? You want to amend your answer?
No, I'll never amend my answer. It's a sign of weakness. But the position is just that in terms of we're looking at documents that would be released and the secrecy issue, which is what Section 5 deals with, we just feel that the chairperson of the committee would be the person best placed to make a final decision. But then in particular examples, because we haven't experienced this ourselves.
Okay then, honourable members, that's that. I don't think you can take this thing any further, honourable member. Thank you very much for attending these public hearings, Mr. Lee and your colleague. We really appreciate your input. And on behalf of the committee, I thank you for coming. Can we then proceed to the next presenter, who is Mr. Baden-Hobbs. Is Mr. Baden-Hobbs present? The Cyberman. Yes, Honourable. Questions or close now?
Chairperson, we are getting strained as presenters are sitting on that side and you are on that side. Can't an arrangement be made that presenters come closer to us? Please.
Mr. Bowdenberg says, a request for you to come closer to the action. Is it possible to do that? There are some seats here. These are executive seats. I'm sure you'll be comfortable there too. Mr. Bowden is welcome. You seem to have a specific area of concern. Can we hear you? And can you inform the committee how your concern relates to the amendments that are being considered by the committee? Over to you, sir.
Chairperson and the honourable members of this committee, I'm indeed honoured and very privileged to address you today. My name is Fani Bardenhorst. My background, I joined the South African Air Force in 1968. In 1973, I graduated as an engineer in electronics. And in my time in the Air Force, I concentrated on navigational systems of aircraft, hence my first introduction to computers. In 1977, I joined the former Department of Foreign Affairs, where I served as part of the technical division responsible for electronic security in the department. My division was called TRAC, Telecommunication, Research, and Cryptography. In 1994, I was absorbed into the security group who accompanied former President Mandela on his travels abroad. My responsibility was his electronic security and communications. In 1997, I started my own company, and today I'm a director of an IT company and a training college. I have submitted a copy of my concerns to this committee. My interest in the amendment of this act is focused on the covert action and not the overt action. As I've mentioned in my document, the threat is that information can be leaked or printed without the official doing it being identified easily. The solution is how to make sure information remains restricted and available to only those who meet concerns, the need-to-know principle, by implementation of a uniform system and coordinated by representatives of all role players. I wish to draw your attention to what we regard as one of the root causes of the problems in intelligence. If we have a law that says you are not allowed to leak sensitive information, we are merely addressing a symptom. It is the lack of the protection of sensitive material or data that should be addressed. The protection of our data and information is what eventually becomes intelligence, and that is the root cause that we wish to address. Not what is wrong, but why it is the problem. If I can build a dam and fill it with water, but construct the inside of that dam as a beehive, I can protect the water in that dam to a large extent. Should the dam wall start cracking, even if the dam wall breaks in places, I shall still protect most of the content. What I'm trying to emphasize is that the personnel officer in a department should not have access to the line function report regarding trade agreements with another country. Likewise, the line function official should not have access to all the personnel files of that department. Regarding the NCC, it is our vision that a single body, e.g. the NCC, cannot protect solely utilize the intelligence derived from the proliferated information which is available in all government departments and public entities. We believe that this can only be regulated through a coordinating body, but that each government department and public entity that deals with sensitive data should have their own component dealing with a specific environment and be represented in a coordinating body. Graphically, this can be demonstrated as if all these public organizations are functioning within their own circles of influence. In fact, they will be overlapping with some departments, overlapping more with some than with others. But if all these circles of influence are put together, it is only at the core where all these circles overlap. That is where the information of all concentric circles of influence meets, and where all the available information should be analyzed and turned into intelligence through a concerted and coordinated effort. I've drawn a little diagram to show the various departments that deal with sensitive information whom we feel should be a part of this body. All these public departments should have interoperability that will allow them to use the coordinated intelligence rather than proliferated information, which may be inadequate to facilitate proactive action and proper decision making. In the end, all departments and public entities should be a part of the puzzle, or call it intelligence. That puzzle can never be completed to show the big picture unless all the pieces come together to ensure a coordinated approach. Availability of data or information, its analysis, and the means to ensure its availability on a standard dashboard, on the dashboard for all relevant decision makers in the sphere of interest and influence, with the use of state-of-the-art technology, is what we are recommending. These issues are like a hand in a glove and cannot be dealt with separately without being detrimental to the other part. A coordinating body consisting of a representative from each department concerned working together to complete the puzzle and ensuring that all data are related, be detected, fed into the system, analyzed, and through an early warning system proactively provide the president with reasonable time to make decisions on the actions that should be taken. It will also allow for better decision making in government departments or entities when the proliferated information has been consolidated and scientifically analyzed. A single department cannot fulfill this function and be successful without the buy-in of all the others. All the information needs to be available, be protected within its own environment, and each of the relevant departments should be represented in the coordinating body that primarily will keep the president informed. In each department, people concerned with this should be trained in the identification and protection of sensitive data. All data found across government and the public entities should therefore be available to the coordinating body that will extract information, analyze it, and complete the process of turning the proliferated data, which may be irrelevant on its own, into intelligence. As an example, on 9/11, one of the worst disasters occurred in New York. Bits of information were proliferated among many government departments and agencies with no mechanisms in place to put the bits and pieces of information together to have a complete big picture of the situation. If a coordinated approach had been followed, it could have resulted in the probable prevention of it happening. The need, therefore, is not only the protection of information, but to ensure a consolidation of the proliferated data and through systematic analysis transform it into intelligence. This in itself should be a prerequisite and cornerstone of an early warning system. As mentioned in my document, currently only symptoms are addressed, i.e. what is wrong, but not the root cause of the problem. Why is it a problem? It's my view that intelligence cannot be protected or regulated by laws only. We must address the root cause. That is why we would like to recommend that a coordinating body be established. All relevant departments and public entities should be represented rather than a single department deciding and dominating all others to the detriment of the security of our country. Participative management is a reality that works and is embraced by all. Another example is the security officer from ADT who installs my burglar alarm has not the ability or the expertise to oversee the security of my IT network. Even though he or she may be a security officer, that person knows nothing about firewalls and the security of an IT engineer, who is an expert on firewalls again, may not be necessarily an expert on the installation of alarm systems. However, both these people are needed, the one to do the physical protection and the other to do the information protection. Each department is unique, and the aim must be to establish an integrated system and not an environment dominated by one prescriptive entity which are without the knowledge, expertise, and or capacity to do so. I also address the issue of technological innovation, which is creating a rapidly and ever-changing environment. To ensure that a coordinating approach be adopted, technology refreshing should be done on a uniform basis, and departments and public entities should refrain from unilaterally go ahead to implement systems which may be incompatible with the uniform approach approved system. These two issues, which I have addressed at length in my letter, cannot be approached separately and should be regarded as two parts which should be addressed simultaneously. Chairperson and honourable members, I thank you, and I'm now open for questions.
Honourable members. Yes, the honourable member, Amato Kani.
Thank you, honourable chair. I just want to ask the presenter here, because we're dealing with the amendment of various pieces of legislation into a consolidated one. Now, I want to understand the coordinated body that brings this department in terms of the diagram together. In law, I mean, I just want to understand, is it the presenter proposing that in terms of the, there should be a policy that brings this department into that particular coordinated body? Or does he suggest that, as we speak and talking about this particular amendment, that in law, this is what we need to do in bringing these particular departments together? Is he suggesting that we do a definition, and a definition that brings the department together, and then go into a listing of the function of that particular body? Is that what the suggestion, the presenter is suggesting? And if so, does he think that the mechanism that is stated into the draft bill currently, it's not sufficiently addressing the concern about coordinated and integration?
Mr. Badenos, you understand the question?
No.
In the middle of page 3, you are talking about this coordination body that is...
Chairperson, in yesterday's Citizen, there was an article of someone working on the police's computer, who downloaded information and then sold it to the press. Before I came for this meeting, I tried to speak to the CETA representative who is currently in charge of all security in government. This gentleman was too busy and can only see me on Friday. He couldn't see me before I came down here. And when I started asking around, nobody knows this person who is the head of security at CETA in government. So I'm really worried about that. Everybody is doing their own thing. We're going to change a law. We're going to have a law protecting information. But on the ground, the people that are dealing with these things are not working together. And there should be a body created. We're at the core of my diagram. And that core can be chaired by the NCC. It can be chaired by anybody else who is concerned or whose responsibility it is. But without people working together in the different government departments, there is no way we're going to protect information in this government. That is my concern. Does that answer the question?
The Honourable Fischler. Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Badenos, for your input. I think it was a very good one. But I don't know whether you are seemingly contradicting yourself on this issue of saying that you wanted to see somebody but you couldn't see him because he is working independently as it is. Now, and we are also seeing that because of that problem of people working separately, we are bringing them together so that they must be coordinated. Now, in intelligent, you had separate organs working independently. There were many directors, just in intelligence. The director of foreign intelligence, director of media, director of this. Now, they are brought together because one to coordinate them so that nobody must work independently, that we cannot foresee or monitor what he's actually doing. Now, so that this single director now, he definitely, these people, that does not necessarily mean that they are going to be ignored what they were doing before. They're still going to do their work. But now in a coordinated, more coordinated way and controllable. I think that is the main purpose of what we're trying to do. Thank you.
Chairperson, if I can answer on that, I fully agree, Honourable Member. We should get them closer together, but we must not forget that intelligence is only in the National Intelligence Agency, or SAS. That is just one part of our intelligence committee. DIRCO is dealing with the world out there and the diplomatic statements they make, the political reports that come in. That is as highly sensitive as is National Intelligence's information. The SIU, the police started a thing called SWIFT. I don't even know what it stands for. And everybody's doing their own thing. Nobody is sitting around a table discussing how to approach a thing from a centralized point, from working together, getting the equipment that we need developed and a proper structure to get this equipment. A very good idea is if we send data from point A to point B, and that data is sensitive, there was a government department who, about 18 months ago, started using, as I said in my report, smartphones. The minister of that department was informed that the smartphone is secure, she can send sensitive information. We went to the person that said this to the minister and said, you cannot tell the minister that, that is not true. And we were cut off. We were totally pushed away. And they went on until there was an article in one of the newspapers that information sent on a smartphone was used in America. The Canadians gave them access to the data that was sent, although it was encrypted. So what these people misunderstood at the time is that when information is sent from smartphone to smartphone, in that particular case, the servers where that data ends up is in Europe and in Canada. And they were under the belief that that information was in South Africa on the servers in South Africa only. And when we had the blackout last year, we proved our point that the servers are not only in South Africa. Since then, this issue was stopped. The minister withdrew these smartphones. Then we came upon the Apple iPads, which is now very popular with all government senior members, and it's a fantastic way of communication. But currently, there is no encryption on the Apple iPads to secure that data so that we can send sensitive data on an iPad from point A to point B. A fax machine that's been used for a very long time, the technology has changed so much and it's gone so far that there is no current secure fax machine in this country that works for all departments. These things get developed by a company which I mentioned in my document. And the testing of that equipment is done in a little compartment on its own, and then government's told this will work, you can install it. We've been to ministers' houses where these machines are hidden under their desks because it doesn't work. There is no way that our president can phone any of his ministers on a cell phone that's encrypted. So all this has to be addressed. But because they're all working in their little entities, we protect data. We had a judge in a high court. His notebook was stolen while he was actually listening to a court case. 2 days later, people walked into his office and they had all the information on the case that he was working on. We spoke to Justice Pailanga at the time, and he invited us to the Department of Justice to get all the data encrypted on their notebooks. That should a notebook go missing, the data is still protected. That came to nothing. It's almost as if people are protecting their own little environment because they're scared of what they may lose should people find out the level of their knowledge. Not that I'm saying they're not knowledgeable, but it's a protection. In Afrikaans, it's a very good saying. I tried to get an English one, I couldn't. It's Elkeen sit op sy eie miskoek en broei. Now, I couldn't translate that in English. But people are protecting themselves, and that is to the detriment of the security of our president and his government.
The Honourable Bengal, and then the Honourable Mania.
Chairperson, thank you very much. Again, I would want to reflect, for the want of time, I would also reflect to the point that was raised earlier by my colleague next to me regarding the bill itself and what it intends to achieve. I want once again to read what the bill says. The intention of the proclamation was to consolidate the structures concerned and thereby to address the proliferation of intelligence structures. The number of intelligence structures has an unintended consequence of duplicating several support functions. This duplication had a negative effect on the service delivery of the intelligence services. Now, the reason why I'm raising this particular point, Chairperson, appreciating the resume of Mr. Verhulst, is to refocus and then say, what do we want to achieve? So with the inputs that we're receiving, it's assisting us to look into this. Now, thinking about the processes that then follow, the bill, the act, the regulation, do the presenters feel that the oversight that is being done by the JSC and the IG and ourselves is not going to be sufficient enough to factor in such regulations that have been raised once the consolidation and amalgamation is done? Because the issues that have been raised, I don't think, Chairperson, we're not taking cognizance of. We do. But my main focus is to then say we are here to solicit and also listen to all South Africans, irrespective, and take all what they say into consideration. I'm now saying this from a positive point of view rather than to look at the bill on a negative point of view. To then say we are building a South Africa. We are concerned about the things that are currently happening. We want to come up with a bill that is watertight. My question then is that, to Mr. Benenhout, having said all what I've just said, are they not confident enough that some of the issues raised are going to be contained in the regulations and the oversight is going to be done accordingly? Thank you.
Yes, I'm sorry to say that we are addressing a law that many people are up in arms saying government is now going to do things which are kind of inciting. That is not my concern. My concern is that in government we should create a body that can protect that information, that it will not be leaked to people that should not have access to it. And that body that we need to create, I've been trying for 8 years to get that body together. In the last 2 years I focused on two departments, and I had success about 2-3 weeks ago for these two people to meet each other. But at that rate, we're not making progress. We need someone somewhere to realize there is a huge problem and get people like ourselves in, and not the current people that are doing this for government. And we should sit around the table and discuss this, and we should create this body to protect this government and its information.
The Honourable Bengu says that he implies you're ahead of the purpose for which the committee has been established, which is to, as legislation says, is to consolidate a whole range of intelligence entities into one. I think the first question he wants to know is whether you are in agreement with this consolidation, because until that body is formed, your concerns are not going to be addressed. He says then, once this body has been formed, are you not confident that this body will deal with your concerns in the form of regulations? So the first thing, I don't think you've answered the first thing, whether you are actually in agreement with the consolidation of the intelligence entities as they presently are. And then once that body has been formed, which would be the State Security Agency, that's what this amendments are trying to do. Once that body is there now, this new body, he asks, are you not going to be confident that they will address all these concerns that you are raising of security in terms of IT technology and so forth?
In the broad, Honourable Member, I am sorry to say, but I am very worried that this will not be achieved. The current way people are working, and even if we put them all together under one roof, we're not going to achieve this unless, I don't know, somebody has to sit down and find out how it can be done. But I am confident as it stands now, we're going to put everybody under one roof. We're not going to achieve this which I'm addressing here.
Honourable Mania. And then the Honourable Santo, Honourable Maki, we are running out of time, but we'll recognize you, Ms. Honourable Mania.
Thank you, Chair. I would just be interested in hearing from Mr. Bardenos. In your professional opinion, how vulnerable is state IT structure to a so-called cyber attack?
I would suggest you consider very carefully when you answer that question, Mr. Bardenos.
That's a very good question.
Does the answer on Romania? Can we go to the Honourable Santo then?
Thank you, Sir President. I think the intention of public hearings for us as the committee to borrow wisdom from people out there and people and organizations out there. And I think you are saying that over and above the structures that we need to set up as government, the IT side should not be overlooked, which is a very good suggestion. But I think you prefaced your other briefing. I was going through this one, and you were talking through this one. So I kept on trying to chase you, you are saying if data and information can be properly protected, why should there be laws to keep it safe? What does that mean to the entire presentation that you just made?
Honourable Member, when I started work for a minister that in his wisdom one day said, I'm prepared to work for a black president. And we look at this minister, and has he ever been compromised with data that leaked that meant anything? I cannot recall. We protected his data. by protecting data, you cannot have information leaking that can cause damage. Does that answer the question?
Honorable Markey is the last one.
Thank you, Chairperson. My understanding of the presentation by Mr. Badenhorst is that he doesn't disagree with the bill, but he's just concerned that there are some areas that are not functioning optimally, as I see here. And he needs a coordinating structure, which according to me might be NICOG. He might be worried that NICOG is not functional. The NCC is not functioning to the optimal. So I would agree with him and agree with his presentation. Only to say that we are also worried with some sectors of the intelligence that are not working correctly. That's exactly what we need. And since you don't disagree with, all you need is coordination so that these things must function optimally. And I agree with that. And I agree with the presentation. And I agree there are weaknesses here and there. And I agree the coordinating committee, as you suggest, is there, is NICOG. It needs to be strengthened. Thank you.
It's a comment. I'm not sure that you are agreeing on the same things Mr. Badenhorst agrees on, but if you and Mr. Badenhorst are in agreement, I think that's fine. We've come to the end, Honourable. We're running out of time. Mr. Badenhorst, thank you very much for your very mind-searching presentation, and wish you well in the future. Thanks for coming to engage this committee. We'd like to go on then to the third presentation, which is the South African History Archive, Saha. Saha, are you present?
Yes.
Can we start? It's not necessary to read your presentation. We have read it, and I'm sure we will get much more benefit from the half an hour if you can draw our attention to the key issues and then allow the committee to engage with you. You can just introduce yourself.
Thank you, Chair. My name is Tammy O'Connor, and I'm the Advocacy and Training Outreach Officer at the South African History Archive. The South African History Archives is an independent human rights archive that's committed to documenting, supporting, and promoting greater awareness of past and contemporary struggles for justice through archival practices and outreach and the utilisation of access to information laws. So much like the Open Democracy Advice Centre, who presented earlier this morning, our focus is on transparency. So our comments on this bill are not necessarily specifically about intelligence, in which we claim no expertise, but about transparency and privacy, and in particular around transparency, what we see as a missed opportunity rather than the exact amendments proposed by the bill, but what we see as missed amendments that we think should be in the bill that are not. Overall, we're concerned that the bill doesn't address the lack of transparency and accountability that currently surrounds the intelligence services, and it will continue to perpetuate their exclusion from public scrutiny. The bill doesn't address the unconstitutionality, or what in our view is the unconstitutionality, of current laws and practices of the intelligence services. And we also think it creates the potential for the unwarranted restriction of an individual's right to privacy. So just to sort of set the framework, which I'm sure you're all aware of, but it never hurts to have a reminder, is that the Constitution in Section 32 guarantees everyone the right to all information held by the state. And that is realised in the Promotion of Access to Information Act, or PIA. We acknowledge that the right to information is not absolute, and certainly Section 36, subsection 1 of the Constitution allows for reasonable and justifiable limitations to be put on that right to information. And they have done so through PIA, and Section 41 of PIA in particular deals specifically with national security and defence. But we would suggest that the three key laws that have been amended by this bill currently allow the intelligence services to operate outside what is considered a reasonable restriction on the right to information within PIA. In specifically, you'll notice in our submission we looked at the recommendations of the Matthews Commission around transparency and used that to address which of the what we consider to be unconstitutional provisions have not been corrected by this amendment. Specifically, we looked at the fact that regulations, which are required by Section 101, subsection 3 of the Constitution to be publicly accessible, are not under these three pieces of legislation. The National Strategic Intelligence Act and the Intelligence Services Oversight Act specifically state that regulations made under those acts need not be made public, and the Intelligence Services Act provides for some of the regulations made under that act not to be publicly accessible. So we would submit that those provisions are unconstitutional. This bill doesn't correct that position and in fact further expands it. It allows now for more secret regulations to be made, specifically around the conduct of intrusive operations and the manner and form in which NICOC may gather intelligence products. And you can see that in Clause 7 of the proposed bill. So our recommendation would be, and our request would be, that the committee reconsider the provisions of the bill to address this unconstitutionality. Another thing we consider in which the intelligence services currently operate unconstitutionally is in respect of audit reports. So Section 188, subsection 3 of the Constitution requires that audit reports of the Auditor General must be made public. Currently, that's not the position, as we understand it, and as reported in the by the Matthews Commission in respect of the intelligence services. Audit reports are reviewed by the JSCI, but they are not, they have been classified as confidential or secret and not made available to the public. And so we would say that that is unconstitutional in terms of the way they're currently operating, and would suggest and request that a specific provision be included in the bill which requires the intelligence services to make those audit reports publicly accessible. In terms of whether there would be confidential or classified information within those audit reports, I would draw your attention to the fact that the Matthews Commission specifically stated that there was no justifiable basis for doing so, and my understanding is they were privy to copies of those audit reports, and also to draw your attention to the fact that the Auditor General has an obligation to keep sensitive information confidential. And the minister has the right to request that sensitive information that could prejudice national security be withheld. So I think such an audit report could be made accessible with any necessary redactions. The budget and financial reports of the intelligence services are not currently publicly accessible. Section 215, subsection 1 of the Constitution requires that national, provincial and municipal budgets and budgetary processes promote transparency and accountability. As with the audit reports, currently the budgetary reports of the intelligence services are submitted to the JSCI, but they're not made available to Parliament or the public. And so again, we're recommending that a specific provision be included in the bill which requires those documents to be made publicly available. Um, note and welcome the addition of a new provision within the bill which requires that the annual reports of the intelligence services are made publicly available. They are to be made publicly available with the redaction of classified information, and our concern around this is the breadth of classified information under the Protection of Information Bill, and I note the Chair's earlier comments around that, and I am aware of the recent and welcome changes to the definition in particular of national security, which is the central tenet for classifying information. But you will see in our written submission, and we also made a submission on the Protection of Information Bill, we do not think that the national security definition has been sufficiently tightened, and specifically in respect of the fact that it's an inclusive, not an exhaustive definition. It still allows for information to be classified on the basis it's a state security matter. We have numerous problems or concerns with the definition of state security matter. So just to highlight those, and those are spelled out in our submission. The other key recommendation regarding transparency of the Matthews Commission was that the national intelligence priorities be made public. Currently, the National Strategic Intelligence Act requires that those documents be provided to, NICOC provide those documents to Cabinet, but they're not made more broadly available. We would submit that the public should be aware of those priorities in order to be able to engage with them and assess them and to hold the intelligence services accountable for their actions. Obviously, we have not been privy to such documents, and it's hard for us to assess whether there would be national security information contained within them, but I would again draw your attention to the Matthews Commission, which stated that the priorities do not contain information that would be of concern to national security, and did not see any specific need to limit those and not make them publicly accessible. So we would again request that a new insertion be put into the bill which requires the national intelligence priorities to be made publicly available. The final issue that we see with the bill, and this relates to a direct amendment proposed in the bill, concerns the right to privacy. So the right to privacy is currently protected by Section 14 of the Constitution, and so as with access to information, can only be restricted but with reasonable and justifiable limitation. What the bill does is insert a new provision that allows the State Security Agency to collect and analyse foreign signals intelligence in a manner prescribed and in accordance with the intelligence priorities of the Republic. The definition of foreign signals intelligence is in our submission very broad, and in the reality of modern communications would allow the monitoring of both domestic and foreign intelligence. There is no detail within the bill about how that will be done, how it will be monitored and how it will be collected and how it will be analysed. It's left to regulations. I would submit that it is so substantive and so imperative in its limitation of the right to privacy that those kind of provisions must be included in a substantive law that is subject to public consultation such as this one, not in regulations where the minister need only consult with the JSCI and which arguably may be able to be kept secret under the legislation. Specifically, I note that there is nothing that requires this kind of intelligence monitoring to be subject to the provisions of RICA, and there are no requirements regarding the maintenance or disposal of records gathered through that monitoring. And we would submit that needs to be reconsidered and that specific targeted monitoring must be done in accordance with RICA. We acknowledge that is very difficult for the broader environmental scanning, but that reasonable limitations and requirements must be considered and put within the legislation that don't unnecessarily interfere with privacy, and that the bill must deal with the disposal of non-pertinent information, especially that may be collected through environmental scanning. Thank you.
Honourable members, Honourable Markey, Honourable Fifo, Honourable Gabatelli.
Thank you, Chairman. Well, I've got one or two observations and questions. I think the main focus of the presentation is transparency. That's what they want. And we are talking about the Secret Service. So if we mix the two, secrecy and transparency, I don't know what it gives us. And that's why these services are called spooks. It means they are secret. So if you want transparency in the Secret Service, what are we talking about? Are we not mixing oil with water? There cannot be transparency. At what level do you want transparency? If I was to give an example, if you wanted the budget of special operations or of covert operations, what do you want? The fact that you can say it's 1 billion, you have already exposed how much they can do. So it means maybe even the budget itself, you can't tell. If you say 500,000, then it means the other agency in Europe knows already that is not effective. They can't do anything. So my approach would be that, and you don't come up with suggestions. Or, you know, if we mix water with oil, as you suggest, what should we do? And there's somewhere where you say about bulk interception of communication. If you are a citizen of South Africa and somebody needs to intercept your communication, it has got to go through a judge. That is what the citizen is protected. But for the bulk information that goes all around, you have got every right to harvest it as much as you want. I wouldn't know if a South African citizen is talking to an American citizen, what are you to do? But it's there for you just to pick, right? So unless if you have got a suggestion. Thank you very much.
Honorable member, you were referring to bulk communications, you were referring to things outside the borders of South Africa, I take it. I made that clear then. It's comments, I don't know if you want to comment on the comment.
Thank you.
Yes, sir. Fine, Honourable Member.
Yeah. Okay, don't allow me. That's
lucky. You're not in the queue.
Just before you.
Oh, sorry, you are in the queue. You are actually next in the queue. Thank you, Honourable. You may proceed.
I'm sorry. Now, you just on this question of the first sentence theme, that everyone has the right of access to any information held by the state. I think that is serious. Just that statement itself. I mean, that is reducing transparency to uncertainty. If South Africa, the army in South Africa is busy making a bomb in the nuclear nation there, a nuclear bomb. Now, does that mean that everyone has must have access to that information about that, making the bomb? And we making South African security naked to any country. If South Africa has established has a secret with another country, and that secret must be protected because it may jeopardize the relation between South Africa and that country, should that be open to the public? Isn't that destroying the relation of South Africa with other countries? They say the public should be aware of the national security priority of the country and be able to engage with and access those priorities. What does that mean? Because if I say South Africa is making a bomb, a nuclear bomb, it's a priority. Now, should then the public have access to that? Go to that factory that's making them there, because it has all the rights. I mean, I think that is reducing transparency to absurdity. That's what I'm trying to say. So that I think we need to understand the question of intelligence and secrecy and transparency, and the difference between intelligence and the other departments, how different it is. Because intelligence is protecting the security of a government, not to expose it to the world, not to expose it to enemies of South Africa. That's what I mean. Thank you.
Yeah, Honourable Members, I think the presenter recognises the limitation in Section 36. They are seasoned presenters at Parliament, so I'm sure they're very much aware of Section 36. But I think the point that the Honourable Markey has made is just where do you meet? What is the extent of the limitation? Can we hear you on that?
Thank you. Just to answer first the issue around transparency more generally, and to point out to the Honourable Member that the quote that everyone has the right to any information held by the state, that's a direct quote from Section 32 of the Constitution. It's not some principle that Saha has put out, but it's actually in there in the Constitution, and we do recognise that it's subject to the reasonable limitations in Section 36. But we submit that those reasonable limitations were thought out when the government produced PIA, the Promotion of Access to Information Act, and it specifically deals with international relations, national security and defence in Section 41. In relation to the budget issue, and it's a shame I don't have the reference here with me, but the Matthews Commission specifically spoke about what they call a misnomer, that to provide details such as $1 billion has been spent on covert operations would somehow give a European state an advantage over South Africa is a complete misnomer. You wouldn't need to go into the level of detail about how that R1 billion is being spent. And I also would like to point out that Section 199 of the Constitution specifically states that the security services must act and must teach and require their members to act in accordance with the Constitution and the law, and that the fact that budgetary processes should be transparent and accountable is contained in the Constitution. And it's actually my personal view that if a request for those budgets to be made were to be made under PIA and they were not to be released, we could easily raise a successful court action to get access to those documents, because they're not something that has been identified as in need of protection from the release to the public. And perhaps if they go into such detail as to provide or information that would threaten national security, it could be redacted, but that on the whole, the broader parts of the budget would be accessible. In relation to the issue of bulk communication, and I assume you're meaning just environmental scanning between South Africans and foreign states, is that right? So when just random assessments rather than targeted assessments, is that correct? Okay. I do acknowledge that in those circumstances it would be very difficult to require judicial authorization. But that's why my concern about the absence of provisions requiring the destruction of information that is non-pertinent is of such concern to me. Because if lawful activity is being included in that environmental scanning, which it must be, then there must be a requirement that that be deleted or removed or destroyed so that it does not continue to sit within the intelligence agencies when it's not relevant. In relation to your comment about the judicial authorization being required in terms of domestic communication, it's my submission that this bill would allow that not to occur, that in fact the foreign signals communication, foreign signals intelligence, the definition is such that if a server is hosted overseas, as so many servers are, then that would mean a communication between two South Africans that passes through a server in the United States, for example, would then be subject to this foreign signals intelligence. And in those circumstances, there's no requirement that monitoring of that be subject to RICA, even where it's targeted. So there's no requirement at this point for judicial authorization. The mode and manner in which that is to be done will be included in regulations. And so we don't know to what extent that will allow for targeted monitoring of people without judicial authorization. I would also just say that the Universal Declaration of Human Rights protects the right to privacy of everyone, whether they are living outside South Africa or in South Africa. And South Africa has undertaken in the Constitution to uphold international agreements like that to which it is a signatory, and I think this kind of arbitrary monitoring of foreign communication, or perhaps targeted monitoring of foreign communication without judicial authorization, specifically breaches that universal right.
Honourable members, I have a long list here and we are running out of time, but we have on my list Gabadelli, the Honourable Gabadelli, Honourable Mania, Honourable Santa, Honourable De Brain, and then the Honourable Mafakani. Before you proceed, Honourable Gabadelli, the presenter has already up front said that she and that the organisation has no expertise in intelligence, so I would request that the honourable members don't concentrate on attacking a member for a lack of knowledge on intelligence matters. Where she has spoken on intelligence matters, she has made it clear that she's referring to Matthew's report. So please, can we just not attack the member because of a lack of honourable?
Thank you, Chair. Thanks, the President. You are right, I won't say anything about intelligence matters. Correctly, as you are saying, the presenter is concentrating on transparency and not intelligence. I just want to find out two things. What was the ultimate purpose of attaching the protection of information bill in the presentation when you submitted? The second issue is the issue that I asked from Open Democracy. Precisely because you don't have that much experience as the chair is protecting you, that much experience in intelligence, did you focus as to why the amalgamation is necessary?
which is the purpose of why you are sitting today, as outlined in the bill? If so, are you opposed to the proposed amendment informed by the proclamation by the President in September 2009, which doesn't want you to know much more intelligence, but that's why you are here today, about that thing?
Thank you. In terms of why we submitted the Protection of Information Bill submission with our submission, it's simply because we referred to it in there and we were aware that some members of this committee are not on the other committee. When I made my presentation earlier, you would have noted that I referred to our concerns about classification and how that interrelates with the publication of the annual report, which will now be required under the amendments being instituted by this bill. And so we attached our submission just so that members were able to read in detail in that submission our concerns on the classification of information, so they could assess how it would relate to this bill. In relation to the amalgamation, look, I understand that a number of persuasive arguments have been put forward in support of amalgamation. If requirements of transparency are met, we don't have a view either way in relation to amalgamation or non-amalgamation. I think as long as the organisation, however it is constituted, is subject to oversight and scrutiny, then we don't have a concern about which way it's constituted.
The Honourable Mania.
Thank you, Chair. Before I ask my question, I must express surprise that my friend, the Honourable Markey, is not familiar with the governing formula in the ruling party, which is secrecy plus transparency equals grace secrecy. Chair, my question is, there's very little with which I disagree in this presentation, but there is a question of fact which I think needs to be cleared up. I'm not sure that the presenter would be able to clear up this fact, but perhaps you, in your capacity as chair of the Joint Standing Committee on Intelligence, would be able to assist. And that is the whole question of the Auditor General's reports. I share the concern of the presenter that the Auditor General's reports are not made public, but my understanding is that, in fact, they may be made public. I certainly have copies of the Auditor General's reports on the National Intelligence Agency and the South African Secret Service, and they certainly make very interesting reading. They seem to suggest that at least a couple of years ago the Spooks lost some safe houses. But the question is, could you just clear up the facts? My understanding is that the Auditor General's reports are in fact made public. Is that correct or incorrect?
Honourable Mania, the presenter is running out of time and there are other members that would like to ask questions. Is that the only question that you have? You not got other questions after that? Then my answer to you is we will deal with that matter when the committee deliberates. But yes, if you look at the reports of the JSCI over the past few years, you will find that the Auditor General's report is attached to the report of the JSCI, which is the annual report which is tabled in Parliament. The next presenters, and I would urge you to be concise, as the Honourable Sonto, then the Honourable Devain, and then the Honourable Amerikani.
Constitution. Is not what we are dealing with here. Section 14 is dealing with an individual, not the state. So I just wanted to make that comment, Jefferson, and I won't ask any question.
That is well said, Honourable Member. The Honourable De Bruyn, and then the Honourable Matakani.
Thank you, Chairperson. I want to say to the presenter, as I was listening to her submission, I get the impression that the whole basket of items that you have submitted to us in the form of the public engagements and on the national intelligence priorities, etc., gives me a concern, because it seems to be over-reliant on the findings of the Matthew Commission. And I think I want to stress and emphasize that the Matthew Commission was not processed and adopted by government. So I thought that is important for you to understand.
A statement, not a question. Thank you, Honourable Member. The Honourable Lakani.
Thank you, Honourable Chair. Just two small questions on page 6 on the submission. There seems to be a concern with regard to the information which is stumbled upon in the course of the gathering. Now, no proposal is suggested in that provision. I wonder whether the presenter had any suggestions to make on that, because she referred to the regulation may not necessarily, I don't know, may not make contain such a provision. Whether there is any, has there been application of mind to a problem at hand? There seems to be that problem. The second question is the constitutionality aspect. I know that in that page and various other sections of the presentation, there is a statement that indicates that some of the pieces of legislation are not quite in compliance or in the requirement of the Constitution. Now, I don't know what is the authority of that statement. Is it just a statement of somebody, or is it a serious opinion on that in terms of the authority of the statement? I struggle just to follow the argument like that if there isn't any opinion attached to it or authority that gives authority to a statement of unconstitutionality, whether such exists. If not, so it's probably 50-50 can be said as for fact and definite, but I just want to hear the presenter on that particular aspect of the constitutionality. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. The issue of constitutionality, I think I said a few times, and perhaps I've missed saying it every time, that it's in our submission that it's unconstitutional. So it's an assessment made by the South African History Archive. It's not an assessment I'm aware of in any kind of case law. And it is, our assessment is consistent with some of the assessments in the Matthews Commission report, but that it's not something that's been determined by any judicial authority that I'm aware of. In terms of the question around the, I think you're asking for a suggestion about how environmental scanning should be regulated. Was that the question?
Yeah, the question is in relation to the Communication Related Information Act. There's something that you say in the document that the information or in the process of gathering of information and you stumble upon the information about intelligence, there is no provision in the Act that prescribe how such information should be either disposed of
or should be either erased from the information, which is almost an indication of worrying about information that could be utilized for purpose which was never gathered for, or either got permission through the judge. So that's why I was asking the question. You say that it's a problem, but you have not necessarily say in order to, if there is a problem, to curb such a problem would have been in the law, in the manner, in this particular manner. So I was trying to elicit your opinion around this problem statement that you presented.
Thank you for the clarification. It would be my suggestion that it could be dealt with quite simply by putting timeframes in which non-pertinent information collected must be disposed of. I don't have a suggestion in terms of time frame. I think that would have to be some kind of internal assessment by the people working in the intelligence agencies in terms of how long it takes to assess that information as they're gathering it. I don't know.
Honourable members, I think we come to the end of this presentation. The question of transparency and accountability in the intelligence community is a thing that troubles all democracies. It is not a unique concern that we have to be confronted with today. So let's not be unmindful of the situation, but we will always be troubled. Those that champion the rights of the public will always want more transparency and accountability, and those that champion the rights of the intelligence services always going to listen and be very careful as they give off some of those rights. Question of legal opinion, I think we take the point into legal opinion, the constitutionality in today's world. There are so many lawyers and so many advocates that have different legal opinions on the same subject, so I think we take note that the opinion of the Saha on this matter. But thank you very much for coming. Honourable members, I'm going to allow you to wet your throats for a few minutes. I understand that there is tea outside, so I would like to adjourn just for a few minutes so that you can have your tea. Can we be back seated ready to take the next presentation at 20 minutes past 11? That would give you something like just under 15 minutes. We are adjourned. The next presenter was meant to be Dr. Matodi Masi Rumbuli. I am told that the doctor will not be attending. So I merely draw the honourable members' attention to the doctor's recommendations on page 3 of his presentation. Something which the committee will deal with when we come to our deliberations. It's not, we won't deal with that now. That means we will go over to the Right to Know campaign, who are next on the list of presenters. Welcome to you. You can introduce yourselves and then proceed with your presentation, honourable members. The Right to Know. I take it as a point of order, honourable member. Request is fine.
Thank you, Chairperson. A request that I don't have information about the Right to Know as an organization, which I should have done, Googled. But if they could, a bit in summary, tell us who they are, what they stand for, and so on. Thank you.
Chairperson, may we begin?
Yes, you may begin.
Thank you very much for having us, Chairperson, and honourable members.
We are from the Right to Know campaign. My name is Murray Hunter. I'm the national coordinator of the campaign. To my left is Vinayak Bhatwaj, who's a member of the Right to Know campaign in the Western Cape. And we just, as a brief overview of what the Right to Know campaign is and who we what we stand for, the campaign is most commonly associated with public opposition to the Protection of State Information Bill. It is a coalition of several hundred organizations across the country who essentially united for the first time as a unified civil society response to the POSIB. But more broadly, we stand for openness, for transparency, access to information, the freedom of expression, the right to association, and the right to assembly. And as a result of the broader civil society coalition that responded to the Protection of State Information Bill, there is also part of our mandate is investigating the sort of the mandate of state security structures and how that interrelates, I think, with the broader discussions we've been having about access to information transparency. As the chairperson has pointed out, there is a balancing act in every democracy that must take place. So we have prepared a brief submission on GLAB, or the bill, if I may. And if I may just start by noting that I've just been informed that several Right to Know members have actually been barred from entering Parliament this morning and are waiting at the entrance as a result of the fact that they're wearing these T-shirts and were told that it was an act of protest to enter Parliament with those T-shirts. And I would appreciate if perhaps arrangements could be made to ensure that they are given passage into Parliament. A similar situation happened in mid-March of 2011, and so it would be appreciated if that could be resolved during the course of this presentation. Moving on with our presentation on the bill, I think just to note our point of departure on this presentation, we are not, I think has been already raised, we are not specifically focused on the intelligence sector. We're not experts on the intelligence sector. We are concerned that the bill is very complex and is far-reaching, that its provisions are not merely technical in nature, that there are, in fact, changes in policy proposed by this bill. And we're concerned that there hasn't been quite enough time for civil society to apply its minds to this very complex and far-reaching bill. I think in particular, Professor Laurie Nathan of the University of Pretoria and the Institute for Security Studies would be leading civil society voices on the policies and practices of the intelligence sector. I know they both did manage to scramble to make submissions in the time provided, but were not able to be present today to submit them. So to some extent, we will defer on the expertise of those two bodies or individuals. On those technical matters. Now, I think our concern is that the domestic intelligence mandates, policies, and practices do need to be the subject of public review. And we're concerned that because this bill does propose things that could potentially be changes in policy, that in the absence of a public review, it is very difficult to legislate broadly. And the last... The 1994 White Paper on Intelligence is in need of sort of updating. And there does need to be a study of international best practice and an evaluation of the current national security climate. And so there is, in that sense, no need to rush this legislation. I do think there's an opportunity for the committee to fully consider all the points that are raised. Our second point of departure is that the Ministerial Review on Intelligence, or what we'll be referring to as the Matthews Commission, that sat between 2006 and 2008 has been referred to extensively in submissions elsewhere. It is the most comprehensive and independent review of the domestic intelligence landscape that we have available to us. And its findings and its recommendations are in the public domain and do need to be addressed. If I can just briefly, using the information that is available to the public, give an idea of our understanding of the intelligence landscape today is that public oversight of the intelligence sector is underdeveloped. There's legislative oversight, there's judicial oversight, and that's fairly well developed. But public oversight, which is usually the third pillar of these things, is underdeveloped. And part of that is a result of poor flow of information between these organs of state and the public itself, what's been referred to as transparency. The expansive national security mandate includes really all aspects of political and economic life in our country. There's a concern of increased politicization of the intelligence and security services, and there are concerns of constitutional infringements in the course of the intelligence services doing their job, which includes illegal interception of communications by the NCC, which has been covered in other submissions, and we will briefly cover it as well. Just to summarize our concerns with the bill, then, is that we do believe that the bill in its current form promotes a dangerously broad domestic intelligence mandate, and we submit that this mandate needs to be much more clearly and narrowly defined in any legislation. We believe it expands powers to monitor and intercept domestic communications without adequate regulation and without proper judicial oversight. And we also believe that the bill does have the potential to diminish public oversight of state security bodies, and we urge the committee to be alert to this. Our concerns do break down into two sections. And the first is the mandates and practices of state security bodies, and the second is with regard to interception and monitoring of communications. So if I can just broadly give you an overview on the mandate of state security bodies, we would like to particularly draw your attention to the definitions of counterintelligence, the definitions of domestic intelligence that's contained in the National Strategic Intelligence Act of 1994 and is not currently addressed by the GLAB, and the interplay between the definition of national security and state security matters. On the first point, the counterintelligence mandate, Section 1B of this bill defines counterintelligence as measures and activities conducted, instituted, or taken to impede and to neutralize the effectiveness of foreign and hostile intelligence operations, to protect intelligence and any classified information, to conduct vetting investigations, and to counter subversion, sedition, treason, and terrorism and related activities. I think that we've identified, just in broad terms, really a two-tier problem with this definition that we'd like to address here. The first is on the inclusion of impede, neutralize, counter. This is a concern that is already well noted and on record that the bill doesn't provide clarity on what constitutes impeding, neutralizing, or countering such activities. And in light of concerns that such countermeasures may risk infringing on constitutional rights, we submit that very clear guidelines are needed to ensure that these countermeasures are appropriately limited. On the second point, the inclusion of subversion and sedition in measures that must be addressed by the counterintelligence mandate. These are exceptionally broad concepts, and they do invite an expansive mandate for the state security agency. Subversion is defined in the NSIA, that's the National Strategic Intelligence Act, as any act, I'm quoting here, any activity intended to destroy or undermine the constitutionally established system of government in South Africa. That's Section 1 of that bill. Now, just very broadly, it's simply unclear what it means to undermine the constitutionally established system of government. And I think more clarity needs to be put in there to ensure that it really does provide a clear mandate to the SSA. Now, secondly, that definition of subversion doesn't exclude lawful activities. So potentially activities that are lawful could be considered subversion. And it's a great concern that the SSA is really given responsibility to, you know, and in fact obliged to respond to such activities, even where they may be lawful. And secondly, the inclusion of sedition is as I said, very concerning because it is not clear what constitutes sedition. In common day parlance, sedition could be said to be dissing. It's not clear how that constitutes a national security threat, and I think it needs to be much more strictly and clearly defined. On the SSA's domestic intelligence mandate, we're moving now to the National Strategic Intelligence Act, which I say this is not addressed by GLAB, and it's not going to be amended by the bill, which is of concern. the NFIA says intelligence on, it defines domestic intelligence as intelligence on any internal activity, factor, or development which is detrimental to the national stability of the republic, as well as threats or potential threats to the constitutional order of the republic and the safety and well-being of its people. I think this is again been raised in a number of submissions. It's been raised in public commentary since the release of the Matthews Commission, that there's an urgent need to narrow this domestic intelligence mandate by referring to national stability, by referring to the well-being of the people of the republic in such vague terms. GLUB potentially brings every aspect of South Africa's social, economic, and political life under the SSS mandate. And as we said, it's naturally desirable to restrict that mandate to very clearly define national security matters. Now, there's one final point under this section that is difficult to communicate without our presentation on the screens, but I will do my best and I hope you will indulge me. The GLUB replicates the definitions of national security and state security matter that were drafted.
Santa, can you just hold on this concern? Yes, Honorable Gabadelli.
Okay, apologies for that, Chairperson. Since we had taken your point that we shouldn't read directly from the presentation, we thought we would freestyle. Let me just call our presentation. Can you help me here? We are under Section 2, and we're now on the final point of Section 2, which relates entirely to the mandate of the SSA. Okay, we're now on page 5 of our presentation.
That paragraph 2.3.
Paragraph 2.3, exactly. Okay, now I would also like to highlight that this point is not noted in our submission. I think in the conclusion of the submission, we did note in the short time available, we were only able to give a brief overview, and we would like to expand on it in the presentation. So if I can ask your indulgence to include this point. The definitions of national security and state security matter contained in GLUB are also, they are identical to those in POSIP, and I think it's already been reflected that those definitions were worked on for a number of months in that committee, and of course they are still contested by civil society, and that's happening in the NCOP right now. Just our concerns with national security, the inclusion of economic and technological and scientific secrets vital to the republic, as noted by ODAC, I think that there is a concern that this brings economic and commercial information inappropriately under the mandate of the SSA. But as the definition of national security relates to the definition of a state security matter, there's an interesting interplay here which unintentionally broadens the protection from public oversight given to the SSA. And I would just to read from the bill, national security includes the protection of the people of the republic and territorial integrity of the republic against, moving down to subsection 4, exposure of a state security matter with the intention of undermining the constitutional order of the republic. Now, elsewhere in the bill, it says that a state security matter includes any matter which has been classified in terms of any national law and which is dealt with by the agency or which relates to the functions of the agency or to the relationship existing between any person and the agency. So that's a state security matter. Now, because the definition of national security includes the exposure of any state security matter vital to the constitutional order, if you read those definitions together, it simply means that national security includes the protection of the republic and the territorial integrity of the republic against exposure of any matter which is dealt with by the agency or which relates to the functions of the agency or the relationship existing between any person and the agency. And in doing so, the daily operational activities of the agency, the daily non-operational activities of the agency, things which aren't really crucial to national security, can still be drawn within the definition of national security. And we believe that was unintended consequence of the careful drafting that did go on, but I think that it needs to be dealt with to ensure that it's very clear that the activities of the agency that don't relate directly to critical matters of national security don't get the same levels of protection and are open to public oversight. I'm going to hand over to Vinayak now to deal with concerns around the interception of communication. Thank you.
Good morning, Honorable Chairperson and Honorable Members. Thank you for this opportunity to present. My presentation will be dealing with Section 3 of our written submission pertaining to interception of communication, where we have three broad areas of concern. The first being the lack of judicial oversight for the interception of foreign communications. The second being the definition of foreign signals itself, which we believe has the potential to overlap into an inclusion of domestic signals. And finally, bulk interception, environmental scanning, which we believe remains unregulated by this legislation. Just underlying our presentation is the sentiment that any invasion of privacy is an extremely intrusive measure for which the burden of proof and the justification lies strongly within the state security agencies, and we believe that burden of proof on this reading is currently insufficient. Section 1C, dealing with the lack of oversight for interception of foreign communication, states foreign signals intelligence means intelligence derived from the interception of electromagnetic, acoustic, and other signals, including the equipment that produces such signals, and includes any communication that emanates from outside the borders of the Republic or passes through or ends in the Republic. This particular section, which contains any communication emanating outside the border, passing through, or ending in the Republic, doesn't seem to require any warrant for the interception of foreign communications. Therefore, domestic intelligence seems protected, but it seems that it's open seas as far as interception of foreign communications is concerned. This particularly worries us because it potentially violates the international treaties to which South Africa is a signatory, including the UN Declaration of Human Rights and the International Convention on Civil Rights, the International Covenant on Civil Rights. There is no provision for non-monitoring of South African citizens who happen to be abroad communicating with individuals domestically, and there's also no protection for South African citizens who may be recipients of communications sent from overseas. The point we'd like to emphasize in all of this is that any such interception ought to be with the permission of a judge, and any communication interception without the express permission of a judge is unconstitutional. We also believe that problematic in this definition of foreign communication is that it doesn't protect communication that occurs with one leg in another country. So, as has been mentioned, when communication between two individuals is domestically occurs via, say, email or through social networks, if this communication is routed to a foreign server overseas, the exception of this kind of domestic communication wouldn't be protected under this legislation, and we think strict judicial oversight is required. The third leg of this particular concern of ours, 3.3, bulk interception and environmental scanning, we believe must be strictly regulated. The bulk monitoring conducted formerly by the National Communications Center and now by the State Security Agency involves scanning by the use of keywords, names, addresses, etc. We believe that we understand that the current practice is purportedly to discard any intelligence from bulk monitoring within 3 days if found to be impertinent, and where targeted scanning will take place, we understand that a RICO warrant will have to be obtained. In our reading of this bill, the GLAB is silent on this, and we would like clearer articulation of this point. Finally, we'd also insist on strict judicial oversight in very determination of the keywords used to motivate a bulk scan, and also on what information is retained and how this information is used. I'll hand over to Murray to conclude our presentation.
Thank you. Look, I think that in the final summary, we do believe that purely on these points alone, and we have given a very broad overview of just a few points. This bill is far-reaching. I don't believe that these provisions are purely technical. I think this does constitute a shift in policy. According to the findings of the Matthews Commission, this is legislating existing practice into policy. We're concerned about this potentially dangerous broad domestic intelligence mandate. That's a phrase, again, used by Nathan in the Matthews Commission. We believe this mandate needs to be much more clearly and more narrowly defined. We're concerned about the expansion of powers to monitor and intercept communications, domestic communications included, without adequate regulation or judicial oversight or any of the rigor provided for in RICA. And we recommend that the committee takes this opportunity provided by this bill to consider issues raised by the Matthews Commission and other reviews and other reports. The domestic intelligence mandate, policies and practices do need to be the subject of rigorous public review. And most especially, we strongly recommend that these issues be opened up to thorough public consultation during this process. Thank you very much.
Honourable members, the Honourable Fichler, the Honourable Santo, the Honourable Markey, and then the Honourable Mania. Honourable Fichler.
Thank you, Honourable Chair. And let us thank the two members on their inputs. And firstly, we are saying that these are merely technical amendments. That's the first point. The white paper was still going to deal with, they're still going to be a review, the white paper, by the government today. So it means there will be more chances of dealing with a variety of issues that may be problematic presently. Thirdly, I want to deal with this question of interception. You know, in South Africa, in the world today, whilst the world is developing and with high technology, crime also has developed. It's a highly sophisticated crime of today. And the criminals of today are big. Some of them are business owners, big business owners. Some own ships, they own planes, some of the syndicates. And you are saying that the government must be reacting on many of these dangerous issues instead of being proactive. Because when you say every interception must go through a judge, you are saying the government must be reactive when syndicates are flying with aeroplanes, they come with cocaine, they come with dollar. South Africa is part of the Interpol Convention. So obviously it has to use interception. It has to get information from other countries about serious infiltration
by syndicates coming to South Africa. It has to get those. And the sooner it intercepts them, the better, before it goes to judges. They say today there are 108 mules, people who are in prison in Britain, or South African people in Britain. There are about 98 people in the Latin American countries are from South Africa. Now, it's because of the interception between these countries and South Africa get to be able to capture these people. And the sophistication of this is that they are using planes, traveling planes. I mean, they have a lot of money, they are millionaires, some of them. In Durban, sometime they caught a ship load of cocaine coming into the country and drugs. Now, you are saying that everything must go through the judge, the line. And we are saying that interception means being proactive to crime and being proactive to sophisticated crime that is happening in the West and is happening in South Africa. And therefore, we are saying not all things can go through the judge. There will be things that have, if for instance, there's investigation of something, that is, we want to arrest somebody, and we have had, we've got information about that somebody, then we have to go through the judge and get it right. Getting further information about that individual. But otherwise, the question of interception has to be proactive for us to be effective in South Africa, to protect the security of the country. Not only in crime, but in many other things. That's going on.
The next one, I think that's a comment which... allow me just to put it in proper perspective so that you don't misunderstand what the Honourable Member is saying. The question of interception with a judge is something that is regulated by the RICA Act. And it is quite clear that in terms of that legislation, it has to be quite a serious offence that has to be committed, and it has to be a last resort. And one will understand that the criteria is all set out in the Act that would warrant the judge to consider your application to be successful. And there are also only so many people or so many entities in terms of the RICA Act that are entitled to apply for such an order. That legislation also allows for interception without the judge's order, provided in very urgent circumstances. You then, at the later stage, within a reasonable time, submit your written application to the judge. So one can understand that where information has come to the authorities' attention that something is happening in real time. It's not possible if we hear now that there is something happening on the harbour docks in Cape Town to confront the judge for the order that the authorities have got in terms of the RICA, the right to proceed and intercept. So I think that's the one context. The other context in which the Honourable Member speaks is obviously the bulk interception, which is outside the borders of South Africa. And I think he's referring to trans-country offences where you're dealing with international criminals, and it is necessary in circumstances like that where you pick up in your bulk interception, where you're listening, eavesdropping to what people are saying to each other out there in the universe. We do it all the time on... emails, and we do it all the time when we search and surf the internet. We look at other people's things, and so it's not a new phenomenon, looking and eavesdropping into what other people are saying. I think that's the other context outside of the borders of South Africa, where you very often, if you listen there, find that there are criminals busy conniving and conspiring. And countries very often share this information, because it might be that South Africa eavesdroppers are able to ascertain that a very serious crime is about to be committed in some foreign country, and you will share that knowledge with them, and likewise. And that is the benefit or the importance of, we understand obviously the concern of privacy and that private communications where you are speaking to your girlfriend without the knowledge of your wife, and you wouldn't want these communications to become known. One can understand that from a private concern, you would be worried whether the intelligence community is not perhaps going to one day inform your wife that you aren't as faithful as you appear to be. And that is something, obviously, that one has to regulate, and I think it's in that context that the Honourable Fichler is talking. The Honourable Sonto, the Honourable Maki, and then the Honourable Mania, Honourable Gabadelli, Honourable Bengo, and Honourable Lakati and Kani, in that order. Can we hear the Honourable Sonto?
Thank you very much, Chairperson. I think I like it when these members, or when Mr. Hunter is mixing presentation with protest. But be that as it may, I agree. I mean, he agrees with us as the committee that a process of this nature that we have embarked on is necessary. All he is complaining about is that we're rushing it. I wouldn't agree with you that we are rushing it. We have engaged on this process because of the one we need. If perhaps we've left anybody, I'm sure there's always a review in the process. But let us just pick up on some of the issues that you identified there. You complain about the public oversight over the agency. And through the document, I have failed to pick up on how do you operationalize this public oversight over this agency. I don't know whether perhaps the public out there should invite the agency and play an oversight over it. I do not understand. But one would want to be appraised on that. You are basing other concerns that you have advanced here on a no-status report of the Matthew Commission, which unfortunately cannot be, entertain. But one needs to pick on the ideas that you are espousing, so that whatever contribution that you make is taken into consideration by the committee. You are citing some subversion, or perhaps you are talking about some of the drafting that would be open for you, for a person to be regarded as subverting some policies, principles, and matters of importance in the country. But I cannot understand how, when the bill is so explicit about these matters, especially when it looks at lawful political activity, advocacy, protest, and dissent from consideration of national security matters. Yes, you are saying this drafting to you is not adequately narrowing what I think you are going to explain to us, the domestic mandate of the agency. Now, how narrow should it be, in your view, so that it can accommodate what you think is a domestic mandate of the agency? The definition of national security is explicitly clear from the bill that it includes the protection of the people of the Republic and the territorial integrity of the Republic against, this is where you have a problem, exposure of a state security matter with the intention to undermine the constitutional order of the Republic. What's your problem in that? Because in my view, that definition is telling you that whatever act you indulge on that is undermining the integrity of the Republic, it would be deemed to be wrong. I'm using a lesser robust word. Lastly, Chairperson, I do not understand, forgive me for my ignorance, I do not understand when you are complaining about having to have a burden of proof whenever something is not being understood by the agency or security agencies. You don't want to prove anything. You just want to go. What is it that you are so anxious to send overseas? Because you always complain about sending things to overseas without a burden of proof. What is it? What information do you want to send to send overseas? I don't think the country is so backward in such a manner that we do not have emails, we do not have faxes. But all those are domestic, therefore domestic addresses. Now, can you appraise us, therefore, why are you so scared of something that will be interpreted to be taking information overseas? But what I like in your presentation, you are not sure of what you are saying. You say it may be. It may be, so you are not sure. There's a probability of some sort of thing, which I like. And therefore, can you explain to us what you mean by those? Thank you very much, Chairperson.
Before you answer, some of the questions that are directed at you, you have already answered. I think the Honourable Member is disagreeing with your answer, and he's merely asking you again whether you stand by that, because I doubt whether you want to, perhaps you want to supplement the answer. I think the question regarding the burden of proof is an issue. I don't think it was the context. I also myself didn't understand the context of the manner in which you raised that. You say burden of proof for the invasion of privacy has not been met. I can't see that there is a burden of proof, you know, related to the question of privacy is related to limitation or, you know, whether there is an invasion and whether it's justifiable in terms of Section 36. But can we have some brief answers, because there are a list of members that still wish to engage with you.
Thank you very much. I apologize for the lack of clarity in the use of that language. As a non-lawyer, I do understand that I was playing fast and loose with the language there. What I meant was that as an intrusive measure, any surveillance of any sort constitutes an invasion of privacy. And therefore, proper checks and balances ought to be in place. And in my understanding, this has been given effect. This right to privacy has been given effect by Act 70 of 2002, the RICA Act. And so therefore, it was to that, the standard of proof required by RICA that I was seeking.
Thank you, Chairperson. Just to address the broader questions, I think first the first point that was raised about monitoring, really trying to use intelligence structures to intercept communication with relation to transnational crime, I certainly understand the difficult position that you're referring to. I think it's very important to reflect what Vinayak has just said, is that there are reasonable grounds provided for in RICA where it is possible to monitor communications with a retrospective judicial permission. But it's absolutely crucial to understand that, as I'm sure you do, that there are treaties in place to which our government is obliged to comply that make the right to privacy an absolute, and judicial oversight is the only thing that can balance that right. That's the reasonable limitation on that right. And so we just need to be clear that there do need to be stricter regulations and there does need to be stricter oversight here. And it's worth bearing in mind that RICA, the RICA Act of 2002, is of 2002, and the concerns that have been raised here, the practices that have been referred to here, have arisen since then, and therefore weren't actually covered in the original the original regulations of RICA, and so I think it is necessary to address that. There's also, I think, a very important question raised about what is a, I can't remember the exact phrase, but what does one mean when he says that the intelligence services do need to be subject to more public oversight? I think we must acknowledge that GLAB does provide. Does make new provisions for the releasing of an annual report from the new body. I think what we do require is a bit more detail there. For instance, the Dutch General Intelligence and Security Services, AIVD, I must say, speaking personally, is not a very progressive organization. They've been known to harass left-wing groups, and they've been known to downplay or turn a blind eye to the national security threats posed by right-wing groups in the Netherlands, but they are legally obliged to produce an annual report that is made publicly available that very explicitly states what strategic objectives, operational objectives, and annual plan, and I think that what the public requires is more information from the intelligence services, and I would agree with the Saha submission that a clear budget and expenditure that does not compromise national security operations does need to be included in that. Now, with regard to the Matthews Commission, it is unfortunate that the Matthews Commission is I think, considered a no-status document, but as we've said at the beginning of our presentation, the findings and recommendations of the Matthews Commission are in the public domain and therefore do need to be addressed. It's a matter of public concern. And it does also, I think I'll take the chairperson's point that some of the questions were more disagreements than questions, but on the definition of national security, I think that I will simply refer to the ongoing deliberations on POSIB in the NCOP, where that issue is being thrashed out now by a range of civil society organizations that are maintaining that a lot of important work is done to limit that definition, but for the reasons that are explained in our presentation, there are still loopholes and the potential that information that should really not fall within the mandate of the security bodies, it does fall within that definition of national security. I think I'm covered there, if you, Chairperson.
The Honourable Markey and then Honourable Mania.
Thank you, Chairperson. I should think most of the things that I'm going to be dealing with might be regarded as comments. First, I would like to say, repeating what my colleague said earlier on, the aim of this process is for the civil society to help in coming up with a law that is acceptable, and it can be acceptable to everybody in any way. And I understand your organization is looking at state security organs or something of that nature, subject to correction. But as I went through your presentation, you don't have any suggestions. According to me, you are standing on a hillock, shouting down everything that is in the bill itself, and you are not offering anything. If you check in there, you are talking about, all these definitions are wrong according to you. It's nothing right. Counterintelligence, you say you want to understand what is impede and to neutralize. Must be explained according to you. But if it was Bin Laden being neutralized, you would understand. Wouldn't be asking questions or being impeded. So some of these things, you see, you must come up with suggestions that we can take and include in this. And you are saying all these definitions that you want. Law works in conjunction with other laws. Can't expect this bill to start explaining what is sabotage, what is subversion, what is terrorism. That is covered in some other laws. And it will be unfair to have this bill explaining everything that you want to understand what are threats to national security. Okay. I'm sorry about that. And on your question of interception, as I said earlier on, there's bulk there. You can all, it's free for all. So you are saying if we want to listen to the pirates that are hijacking ships, we must go to a judge and say, can you allow us to check on them whether we can get the signal from. That is not practical. Especially if that is free for all and there's a crime about to be committed. And on the question of in your conclusion where you say the other committee turned down civil society requests for more time for public comment on the bill. As per letter to the other committee from the Institute for Security Studies and the others. Well, you see, without being rude, I would say the work of Parliament and the work of the state, especially on security matters, must wait. Because somebody must be consulted. I don't think it works that way. Unless if this person has, or structure has
Honorable Markey, there is a point of order.
Chair, Honorable Markey has not asked a question. He has spent 5 minutes denigrating a public submission. If he's got a question of clarification, why did he not ask it?
I don't think he's denigrating. Honorable Member, I don't think he's denigrating. I think he is also raising concerns about the presentation. But Honorable Markey, can we come to a conclusion now? Because we
still have very much. I said, without being rude, I want to repeat that. So somebody thinks he or she can stop the work of government for him or her to go and do whatever without giving a time frame. That is totally unacceptable. And it's being arrogant, according to me, for somebody to do that. Why did the others submit? And that can't be acceptable. Lastly, according to this presentation, you think South Africa will be a paradise that is not known the world over. It will be free for all. Anybody can do anything at any time. Thank you.
It is, am I correct, Honourable Member, it's concerns that you've just raised, it's not questions. Let me put the Honourable Member's concerns. I don't think it is as the Honourable Mania puts it. It's merely that he is complaining that you've got lots of concerns, but you don't have many solutions now. I think in the manner in which the public participates with Parliament and in these public hearings, it's not required of you to offer solutions. You are entitled to complain, and you are entitled to put forth your concerns. And so, I don't want you to feel offended by the members. Statements that you haven't, but it obviously it is very welcoming if there are proposals where there are concerns and you have, you know, proposals as to how to deal with these concerns that you raise. But I don't think it warrants that a response unless you want to give a quick response. We do have some members that still wish to put questions to you.
Chairperson, thank you. I think there was, in fact, a question raised that we would like to address on judicial oversight, if we could, before the Honourable Mania asks this question. And I'll hand over to Vinayak to do that. But just on the issue of concerns versus solutions, I think it's very much our position that we're non-prescriptive, that we don't wish to prescribe solutions to the committee. I mean, there is a brain trust here, of sorts. And we're very happy to raise these concerns and leave it to you. But we do also would like to point you particularly to the submission made by Dr. Laurie Nathan for a number of possible solutions and elegant solutions to the concerns that have been raised. Thank you.
Thank you. I think there's a valid question raised about the need for judicial authorization. And in my research on this, I've noted that the Matthews Commission explicitly deals with the issues relating to judicial authorization, given that there was legal opinion sought by the Intelligence Ministry in which they realized that even internationally there are some jurisdictions where judicial oversight is not required. Examples of this are in UK, in US, and New Zealand, Australia, and they also reviewed Canada. The argument they put forward was that ministerial approval in the draft bill was akin to the discretion conferred on a judicial officer. And the Matthews Commission rebuts these suggestions, firstly by saying that, in their view, there wasn't a sufficient overview of enough jurisdictions. In their view, if Argentina, Austria, Belgium, Estonia, Iceland, Italy, Mexico, Norway, Spain, as well as some aspects of Canadian intelligence legislation were examined more fully, ministerial and judicial approval has been required. Secondly, they argue that in interpreting constitutional rights, foreign laws may be relevant, but they're much less significant than the judgments of our constitutional court. And as noted in section 7.3, the court has emphasized the importance of judicial authorization in relation to infringements on the right to privacy. The legal opinion ignores the crucial differences between a minister and a judge in this regard. Whereas ministers are politicians, judges are formally independent, politically impartial, and unlike the Minister of Intelligence Services, have no functional interest in the gathering of intelligence. Judicial approval thus provides greater assurance than ministerial approval that constitutional rights will not be violated for partisan or functional reasons. Third, the legal opinion doesn't take adequate account of the RICA requirement that intelligence officials and police officers must obtain a judge's permission to intercept communication by a monitoring device. And then, of course, the suggestion was made in that commission that judges might not be able to maintain the confidentiality of classified information, and there's no basis for this assumption in the opinion of the Matthews Commission.
In summary, sir, if I may, the member is right that it is sometimes unpractical to protect those rights, but it is still necessary to do so. Thank you.
Before I get to Rangon Gabatelli, I'm not sure if you were earlier this morning when one of the honourable members did try to place on record what the situation is really with the Matthews Commission and the report. And as Parliament, I mean, how do we deal with something that government says it's got no status? You know, surely the legislature cannot give status to something that government has declared to have no status. It's no consideration. And so we hear what you say, and that you make the point that that's sort of all you have in terms of what is out there that you can rely on. But you must understand the reports of any nature that comes from government, even to parliament, gets interrogated, and even in government, these reports very often can be changed. So I would just want you to respect the decision of government that this report has got no status, and as a legislature ourselves, it is not for us to give something status and to start engaging with the report and looking at the recommendation. Obviously, where you feel that you want to support something that is your prerogative. Can I get to the Honourable Ngabadeli and the Honourable Benga and ask that you be as short as possible, because we are spending over enough time with this presenter.
Yes, Chair, thank you. I'll be very short. Minor question. It's unpaged, but under 1.1, what was submitted to us, point of departure. I want to know what they're departing to with their fifth bullet. What do they mean? Relation with foreign intelligence services and sharing intelligence about South African citizens with foreign governments. I need serious explanation on that one. What do they mean? And two, which is a question also. And a conclusion similar to what has been raised. When they began to open their mouths, they said, they are not going to say much on intelligence. They have organizations, not that much dealing with intelligence. But then they are talking about the public comments on the bill. This is not a bill about sociology. This is a bill about intelligence. So if we are going to take it public without educating the public about what the bill is saying, how were they expecting the public to come here and say about this bill? That's my second question. My last question, I heard something twice They mentioned Lori Nathan twice, and I think Faha didn't hide that they were involved in the tricameral consultation. I'm not sure whether it was a consultation with them and Lori Nathan, or they are representing Lori Nathan, and Lori did submit his own submission. But it has been twice now that they are mentioning Lori Nathan, so I don't know whether Lori is a member of Right to Know, or Right to Know is a member of Lori. Whether Lori is present or not present, is still present when Right to Know is present. These are three questions I'm putting. Thank you, Chair.
Honourable Member, can I just get clarity? Because on your first question, your fifth bullet point question, these are the things that come out of the review, the Matthews review. So just based on what I said now, you're asking for some clarity on a report that we, government has said has got no status, so I would urge you to consider that question. Okay, so we can, okay, so the two. Sorry, Nathan, I think it doesn't have to, you know, people that are concerned about transparency and human rights are very often associates in some way or another. I don't think it needs to be hidden, but the Honourable Member just wants to confirm that.
Chairperson, I do note your point on the non-status of the Matthews Commission, but since those points have now been made under our concerns, perhaps they have status, irrespective of the status of the Matthews Commission. On the question of, perhaps that's an elegant solution to the challenges we face, on the question of Lori Nathan, in fact, Lori Nathan is a member of the Right to Know campaign, as are, I think now, somewhere in the region of 25,000 to 30,000 South Africans. But the submission he made on GLAB, he made in his own capacity. It is not directly associated with ours, although, of course, there was information sharing and an informal study group that's already been referred to. We do think his submission is excellent. We think that his expertise on the intelligence sector is makes him really a foremost expert on the issues that this committee faces. Third question. Sorry, is there a question unanswered that I can answer? I think just to clarify what I said was our point of departure. The Right to Know campaign is not primarily a group that concerns itself with the intelligence sector. So that's where we were departing from. But what is important is that we are focusing in this legislation and in this submission on aspects of the intelligence sector's policies and practices that affect our rights, really, of privacy, the right to access and share information. And that's where the overlap is. Thank you.
Mr. Bingo.
Chairperson, thank you. A lot has been said, Chairperson, and some of the issues raised were some of the issues that I thought I'd be posing questions on. So I don't think I'm going to be asking questions. I just read something on this subject outside that says, when you cease to dream, you cease to live. So we have to dream sometimes. Chairperson, you have said something about the strongly so, the reference to the Matthews Commission. It is a great pity because when the portfolio committee was briefed by the department and the minister, those meetings are open meetings. And a lot of people do make recordings of such meetings, including the secretary of our committee makes such recordings. It has been said time and again, even by the minister, the status of that particular report. But all presenters, with all due respect, the colleagues have been rude, with all due respect, have made mention every time and again
from the Matthews Commission. Now, not hearing what they are saying as presenters, save to quote the Matthews Commission. Now, the claimant now says all that is he has said about the Matthews Commission must then be considered by this committee as there. Now, it baffles me because even they will be fighting outside because there are a lot of them that have made reference to the Matthews Commission that will also be claiming that consider our position as the position. Now, Chairperson, we have heard them. We appreciate that. Even their references to the Matthews Commission, we have heard that. We are going to meet as a portfolio committee to look into their submissions, but the portfolio committee is not giving status to that report at all, except the submission that has been made by the people before us. Then there's the other issue, the question of the sedition that has been talked to about. I'll request that we continuously read and familiarize ourselves about the acts that have been passed, like your Act number 55 of 1977. I think that was 35 years ago. That was 35 years ago, and the Private Security Industry Regulations Act number 56 of 2001. It will talk to the sedition. Then, furthermore, if we go to the issue of terrorism and related activities, Section 1 of the Protection of the Constitution of Democracy Against Terrorism and Related Activities, Act 33 of 2004. Now, a lot has been said about the interception of communication. Our constitution prescribes, and it solely applies within the area of the jurisdiction of the Republic and not beyond those borders. Secondly, our law is applicable in the Republic. I'm raising these issues because we are going to sit down as a portfolio committee and look into all these things. But it is always important that when reference is being made, when beginning to tackle the issues, you also make reference to those acts and then say that act is 40 in 1, 2, 3, and 4. Now, coming back to the issue before us, just as I've said before, is the amalgamation and the consolidation. It is always important that we read that is the purpose of the bill, what it intends to achieve. Because at the end of the day, we end up hearing voices. Yes, we know what is happening in the NCOP and every other thing. So ultimately, you find that we keep on trying to, through the window, bring issues that are not at all related to the matters before us. While appreciating Jefferson what has been said, and issues that might, but the purpose of this particular bill, centered on the issues of a market, is technical amendments. So, having listened to the members, as I said, I'm not going to ask questions. I just felt that I must also raise these particular issues, but appreciating all the presenters that came before us and having raised their concerns, which the committee is going to look into. Thank you, Chairperson.
No comments on the honourable member specifically stated there's no questions. Seems that the honourable member does agree with me on the Matthews report and the status. The others are merely concerns which I think are very similar to what the honourable Marquis was raising. I don't think it warrants as a response. There is still the honourable Ramaphosakane and the honourable Mania. And you two, between the two of you, have got very little time, I would think. 30 seconds for you and 30 seconds for you. Honourable Ramaphosakane.
Chair, thank you very much, Honourable Chair. Much has been said about some of the issue in terms of the interception, but I want to ask on page 5 of this submission, there is something that deals with the that suggests about a definition that requires an overall. Now, the paragraph above that, there seems to be a perspective. Are you standing by that perspective that is contained in that paragraph? The paragraph that you speak about the broadness of the definition. And the last question is in relation to the last page, discarding of recording. Are you suggesting that in the body of the legislation there should be a provision that is inserted? Are you not comfortable about the regulations that may regulate the period in which that has to be discarded, that has been recorded? Are you suggesting that it should be in the body? That's why I'm asking the question there. Chair, I will leave the other issues. There are a number of other issues, but I'll leave that for these two questions.
Yes, right, Jenna.
Sorry, I was scrolling through our presentation, so can I just clarify that I've got the question correctly? I think the question was, are we standing by the time limit within which non-pertinent information is to be destroyed? Beg your pardon?
On your page 5 of the submission, you're speaking about the definition that you say is extraordinary broad. But below that, you then begin to offer some perspective. Now, I was just trying to establish whether beyond this, are you standing with this, what you're saying here, or you still see something else emerging out of this, which is not what you're standing for, what you're saying here, what you're articulating? And that was the first question, because I think you're offering some indications. I wanted to hear what your perspective was.
Thank you, sir. No, we do stand by this.
If I may add to that, I think that we have raised a number of concerns, and as has been said, we've been short on solutions, but the one thing that I think we have to be unequivocal about is that this bill does not address the current urgent concerns about the role of the SSA in our democracy, and that until those concerns have been addressed, no legislation should be passed. So we may essentially we're pointing to things that may be tinkered with, but that fundamental understanding is the bedrock from which our submission is built. Thank you.
The Honourable Mania, you have 30 seconds.
Thank you, Chair. My colleague seems to have used most of my time, so let me be brief. I just want to make a comment. The Honourable Member should be careful of appointing himself as spokesperson of this committee. When it comes to the Matthews...
The point of order, Honourable Member, please.
Chairperson, we are talking about, we are a portfolio committee. At no stage did what he says I did. I was talking as a member of this portfolio committee. And as a portfolio committee then, I was expressing and the processes that we're going to undertake as a portfolio committee. So what I actually raised, in the true sense of the word, was the views and in particular the processes that were followed up to this particular day. Nothing else. What I said is what actually happened in this portfolio committee. And the additional issues that I've raised about the minister being here, about the white paper that is coming that we're going to deal with, and the issues that spoke and talked about terrorism, I was referring to the acts of this parliament and nothing else. I don't know what this particular member is intending to refer to, and worst part of it, pointing a finger at me.
Honourable members.
Honourable members.
I also understood that you were not, I would not have allowed you to speak on behalf of the committee, Honourable Member, but I will study the Hansard and I will report back to the committee on that particular point of order. Can you proceed, Honourable Mania, with comments?
Thank you. I just want to be clear when it comes to the Matthews Commission report that even although government regards it as a no-status report, as far as I'm concerned, that does not invalidate its findings, and its findings will weigh heavily as we prepare amendments to this piece of legislation.
So you intend to give it the status on the
amendment? Point of what?
The meeting is almost finished, or whatever. Who are you objecting to me?
Yeah, I'm objecting to what the member said.
Proceed, honorable member.
Yeah, I think the honorable colleague of mine is out of order. Nobody is saying you can steal those things as they are, and you present them as if they are yours, if it's not plagiarism, you won't be caught for that. But immediately you start saying the Matthew Commission. That is not acceptable. And we have said that hundreds and hundreds of times. So if I was to give you a tip, go and plagiarize and bring here. Thank you.
It's not a point of order, honorable member, but I did hear you. And I am not going to allow a debate on that point, honorable main here. I'm not going to allow you to answer the honorable member because I think
the honorable member is saying that we may not use the M word, Chair. It's like a Monty Python movie.
Honorable members, we have come to the end of these public hearings, and on this light note, honorable member, I will only hear you if it's a point of order, or if you can motivate why you want to put a question now so late. What is it, the point of order?
Chair, it's a serious question on the program, which I wish to address, and which I think will add value.
Honorable member, if you're going to bring value to this process, I will allow it, but if it's not value, I'm going to stop you. Proceed.
Chair, just simply to say that, I think that the public submissions that have been made have added value, but you will know that there are two submissions, one submission from Laurie Nathan and another from the ISS that we have not had the privilege to hear. I would propose that we consider a further session of public hearings so that, in fact, we can hear Laurie Nathan and the ISS. And I say that because Laurie Nathan does have authority on the subject. He was part, I understand, of the white paper drafting process, and he was also part of the commission.
You finish now.
And the ISS also, Chair, has considerable expertise in this field. I think that our deliberations would be strengthened if we were able to hear these two presentations, and I would therefore propose, Chair, that we consider a further opportunity to listen to those presentations at some time in the future. Thank you.
Honorable Santo, and then Honorable Garcia.
Chairperson, thank you very much. I sympathize with the honorable member. We had all these presentations here, and the program of today was from 9 to 4, not to 1 o'clock, but from 9 to 4. My predicament with the proposal would be, if they do not come on the day that we might be setting, then we are sitting with a problem that we were trying to run away from. That there is no program without deadlines. So, on a point of order, Chairperson, these are the presentations. The committee has got, had a chance of going through the presentations. Really, they are quite inviting insofar as information that is here is concerned. We would have loved those two entities, that entity and the person, especially that entity that it was a shop steward of other entities. We would have loved to hear them, really. But we can't postpone our program forever. Thank you very much, Chairperson.
Honorable members, Is there anybody in favor of the proposal that was put forward by the Honorable Mayor? I'm asking the question, are you in favor of the proposal, Honorable Member? I'm talking to Honorable Markey. He's raising his hand. Does that mean that you're in favor of it? Honorable Members, is there anybody in favor of the proposal that we can get finality here? Honorable Mania, you seem not to have anybody that is in favor of your proposal. You're raising your hand to say you're in favor of the proposal. No, no, we're dealing just with the proposal. I just want to decide that thing. Honorable Mania, you have put a proposal. I'm trying to find whether you can get support for your proposal. It appears that you can't get support for your proposal. Now, can we dispense of that matter first? And then I will hear you if you have something, because you said that was your last issue.
The question I have, Chair, might have bearing on the decision and might, in fact, persuade the honorable members on the other side of the House that, in fact, I'm right and they're wrong.
Honorable Mayor, to be fair, you have put a proposal and very few, if not no member, seems to be interested in the proposal. Now, the Honorable Ramathakani is indicating he wants to be heard. Is it on the proposal?
I'm really concerned that people didn't get reasonable notice to attend. I mean, they would have got 1 week notice to attend this public hearing. Perhaps there was a valid reason why they could not attend. They may not have been available. They may have had a competing appointment.
Okay.
There might be a real reason.
Honorable members, and I see that there are non-members of the committee that want to be heard. I'm not going to hear you. This is a committee decision. At this stage, there is no support for that. I'm not saying, as the chair, that is the final say on the matter. As things stand now, it might well be that at some stage there are compelling reasons why the matter should be reviewed. At this stage, let's deal. We came to the public hearings. I don't want the Honorable Mania to make out a case for the Honorable, for Dr. Nathan that is not here, or for ISS that is not here. Let them speak for themselves. I think that would be the proper way to deal with it. Does that satisfy you, Honorable Markey? Because I'm going to go on. And
it satisfies me. Just what I noticed, Mr. Mania didn't include Dr. Maserumulo. Why only the two?
The matter of postponing, extending these public hearings then has been dealt with. The Honorable Mania's proposal has not been accepted, and I have already spoken on my views on how I think the matter could be taken forward, if at all. I think that is the proper way to deal with the matter. Honorable Khani, I thought I dealt with you.
No, I don't remember. I understood, Chair, that you wanted to dispense with the proposal before I ask my question. The question really was, I wanted just to find out whether those who were informed about the public hearing, did they offer explanation why they're not coming to a meeting? In that case, it may then deal with the particular aspect that we are looking for. That's really the question I wanted to know, because I did not hear at the beginning whether they are not going to come and the reason they advanced of not coming.
Yes, the particular submissions that we received from Dr. Nathan and from the Institute of Security Studies, Dr. Nathan is overseas at the moment and apologize that he was not able to accept the invitation. The ISS had one of their presenters one of the key persons that was responsible for drafting their submission is overseas, and the other one is presently involved in other activities. I'm not sure what it was, but that was the reasons given that they were not able to accept the invitation. Yeah, there was something about the service, Public Service Commission that they were attending to. So those are the individual Negre or Negres declined the invitation due to working his working situation. The other doctor that we had down on the agenda did not respond to either the letter that we sent him, the emails that we sent him, the phone calls that were made, many phone calls. We were then not sure whether he was going to come, whether, because he did not. We sent out letters advising the people that they had been requested to attend Parliament for the public hearings, and that was the committee's decision. Everybody got letters, and people were phoned and so on. This doctor did not respond at all to any of the communications, so we put him down just as a precaution, but he did not turn up this today, and so I take it that his absence is an indication that he did not intend to come and deal with his presentation at the hearings. Honourable members, that is it, and we'd like to thank the Right to Know for coming here and presenting. I think that the subject matter of the bill is not the normal subject matter that one deals with in public hearings. Normally, the public hearings are about your day-to-day issues, your housing and your health and what have you, and your judges and your justice stuff. And I think we as a committee will acknowledge that the subject matter is a subject matter that is not normally, it's not your everyday subject matter. But hence we have the public hearings, and it's a constitutional provision that we engage the public, and that is in fact what we have done as we understand the constitutional obligation of Parliament. I think we try, and I try to chair in that context, that we don't, that does not become a confrontational issue. At times it will seem that members are overly concerned and that the engagement might appear to be confrontational, but I think it's more an informative process that we look at. We as the committee would like to be informed. So as we sit, we do look. This was in fact the process we followed with the Protection of State Information Bill, where we did listen and where we heard what many of the presenters said, and in fact did make the necessary adjustments. And I think it's in that context that you must, and all the presenters must see the engagement. We want to learn and see what it is that you see that we haven't seen. The final matter I think I wish to just conclude on is that this whole question of privacy, accountability, and transparency is a thing that I've said earlier on today, is something that all democratic countries are fighting. If this was a dictatorship, we would not be sitting here today. You would just hear that there are new laws that you are obliged to comply with, otherwise you would be landing in jail without a trial. That's the normal dictatorship situation. So this whole question, and as accountability, you will find people on all sides or different sides of of these concepts. And as I said earlier, on the one side, the attempt is always to get as much accountability and as much transparency as possible. And on the other side, there is a concern that too much of the stuff is going to endanger the safety of the country and the national security. And those concerns where people that work in that environment are justified. Sometimes it might be that people are overcautious in that environment, but one cannot ignore the concern that people in that environment have about the whole question of transparency and accountability. And that's not, they are very honest people, they are very decent people working in this community that are protecting our country and do a lot of good work in order to keep our citizens safe. And so we mustn't see the attempt to protect the territory as an over robust situation where you are now moving the country into a security state, as some people have said in the media. We are now moving to an era of apartheid. We would not be sitting here if this was the apartheid era, engaging the people. So some of the comments one reads in the media about what the bill is trying to achieve is somewhat unfriendly when taking into account what I've just said about transparency and accountability. The people that are working in that environment are people that have fought for the freedom of this country, that have fought for these very principles and these very concepts that you now try to protect, and they understand that thing. I thought it's just necessary to put this whole amendment bill in that context. This is not an attempt to take South Africa into a state of secrecy where there is now going to be an intelligence entity called the State Security Agency that will be running the country in the background, and it will subject us to serious oppressive provisions. I don't think that is something that the committee members are in fact going to agree with. Honourable members, having said that, we have come to the end of the presentations from our visitors. The public hearings are over. The issue as to whether when we will have a next meeting, I think it's something I will have to engage with the staff, and I will consult the honourable members of the committee individually to see whether it necessitates to have a meeting in this constituency period again. At this stage, I think the honourable members need to go home, look at their documents, consider what was said here at the public hearings, so that when we come back in the next meeting, we can engage each other and discuss and debate the issues that we hear, and see what issues it is we want to take on board and how we intend to do that. So if you allow me, honourable members, to contact you individually through the staff, we will arrange a date for the next meeting under those circumstances, and I will not today tell you when the next meeting will be. It will not be tomorrow. I will attempt to try and arrange a meeting in the constituency period, so that it doesn't clash with your Easter weekends and your other holidays. And I'll take a majority consensus on that and then notify you. So that then is the issues, honourable members, and I want to thank all of you again, Inspector General, for coming to be present, members from the Ministry, Mr. Robin Slango, members also present here from the Office of Interception Center, the Advocate Kuperi, and other members from the Office of the State Law Advisor, Chief State Law Advisor, staff members, honorable members, thank you for coming here today. This meeting.